exposed to them for centuries because they don't break down.
What are these chemicals doing to us? I'll be testing my kitchen, my bathroom, my producer's cat, and even my own blood to find out. Toxic begins on Monday morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of February. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Amol Rajan in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. 9 people have been killed in a mass shooting centred on a school in Western Canada. And an FBI document says Donald Trump told a senior police officer 20 years ago that everyone knew what Jeffrey Epstein had been doing.
Also in today's programme, we'll be hearing from inside Iran, from those who live and work there, on their hopes for the future.
I think we're going through a really, really hard time in our country, and just nothing is stable here right now. And I guess people are having a really tough time.
The government here wants all secondary schools to have a dedicated special educational needs base. But is the money there to provide them? We'll discuss with a schools minister at 10 to 8. And a lawyer at a landmark trial in California has accused the tech giants Meta and Google of engineering addiction in children's brains. We'll hear from the former Facebook worker, Frances Haugen, on what this trial tells us about the relationship between technology companies and democracy.
I always like to joke, you know, other places can pass laws, we sue. And sometimes there are these large societal problems like tobacco, like opiates, where we can't get Congress to come to a good path forward. And the way it gets resolved is by these large class action lawsuits.
The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
At least 9 people have been shot dead and 25 injured at a school and nearby home in British Columbia in what Canadian officials have described as one of the worst mass shootings in the country's history. Police say the suspected shooter was found dead at the school. According to Canadian media, an alert sent during the attack described the suspect as a female in a dress with brown hair. The Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has called the killings horrific and cancelled a planned trip to the Munich Security Conference. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police said it received a report of an active shooter at a school in the small town of Tumbler Ridge, which lies in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, shortly after lunchtime. During a search of the school, 6 people were found dead, while a 7th died on the way to hospital. The authorities say another person, believed to be the attacker, was also discovered dead inside the building, with what appeared to be a self-inflicted injury. Officials say the shooting at the school and at a nearby home where 2 bodies were found are believed to be linked. The police say they don't yet know the attacker's connection to the school.
A document released in the latest batch of files about Jeffrey Epstein suggests Donald Trump told a police chief in Florida 20 years ago that everyone knew about the paedophile's behaviour. The claim was made in an FBI interview in 2019 with the now former head of Palm Beach Police, who said Mr. Trump called him after an investigation was opened into Epstein. A Justice Department official said they were not aware of any evidence to support that claim. Adam Gochia reports.
The document is a written record of a 2019 FBI interview with the former police chief in Palm Beach, who claims that Mr. Trump called him after the department launched an investigation into Epstein and said, "Thank goodness you're stopping him. Everyone has known he's been doing this." The officer's name is redacted, but the document identifies him as Michael Reiter, who, according to the Miami Herald newspaper, has confirmed that the conversation with Mr. Trump happened in July 2006, when he was the chief of police. The FBI's summary of the interview says Mr. Trump told him he'd thrown Epstein out of his Mar-a-Lago club and that people in New York knew he was disgusting. Asked by reporters in 2019, when Epstein was arrested by federal agents for sex trafficking, if he had any suspicions about the disgraced financier, Mr. Trump said, "No, I had no idea," adding, "I haven't spoken to him in many, many years."
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to push the US to be tougher in its nuclear talks with Iran when he meets President Trump at the White House later. The negotiations restarted last week against the backdrop of a large American military build-up in the region. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
As he has so often in his long political career, Benjamin Netanyahu will be pushing for a tougher US stance against Iran. Last year, Washington joined Israel as it carried out 12 days of strikes on Iran's nuclear and military sites. But now, with the US returning to diplomatic talks, Israel insists that Tehran must not only stop all uranium enrichment, it must also cut its ballistic missile program and support for armed groups across the Middle East. Tehran has repeatedly rejected such demands, suggesting it's ready to limit its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. For his part, President Trump has sought to add to the military pressure on Iran, telling journalists that he's considering adding to his naval armada in the region by sending a second US aircraft carrier.
A report says 3,700 anti-Semitic incidents were recorded in Britain last year, the second highest annual total after 2023, the year of the October the 7th attack on Israel by Hamas. The figures were compiled by the Community Security Trust, which monitors incidents of anti-Jewish hate. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, described the numbers as shocking and said the government was providing record funding for security at synagogues, Jewish schools and community centres. Here's our religion editor, Ali Mukbul.
Last year was the second worst in terms of anti-Semitic incidents in Britain since the Community Security Trust, or CST, started recording such data in 1984. 2025 had the first deadly anti-Semitic attack during those 42 years when, on Yom Kippur in October, two people were killed and three seriously injured at the Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. But what the CST's reporting also shows is that there was a spike in anti-Semitic incidents recorded in the immediate aftermath of that synagogue attack, in some cases involving what the organisation calls face-to-face taunting and celebration of the attack to Jewish people.
A suspect is being questioned in Arizona over the disappearance 10 days ago of the mother of a US television presenter. Nancy Guthrie is believed to have been kidnapped at night from her home in Tucson. The local sheriff's department and the FBI are searching a location south of the city, close to the Mexican border. Senior managers at the co-op have complained of a toxic culture at the executive level of the member-owned group that prides itself on its ethical values. A letter to board members says staff are scared to raise concerns about the direction of the 180-year-old business, which has seen falling sales. Our business editor Simon Jack reports.
A letter claiming to represent dozens of co-op managers speaks of a culture of fear and alienation at the business's top levels that discourages challenge. It suggests this has led to poor decisions that have sapped morale, seen a large number of senior departures, and a sharp drop in profits. The co-op was hit by a cyber attack last spring, which led to a £200 million loss in sales. But some senior managers say a subsequent major restructuring has further damaged the business. A co-op spokesperson said the retailer was in a strong financial position and didn't think the comments were representative.
Simon Jack reporting.
Thank you, Jane. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's start things off by checking the weather, shall we? Simon King's here. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Well, I wish I could tell you something different to what we've had over the last few weeks, but there is more of the same across many parts of the United Kingdom today. For southwest England and across Wales, lots of cloud. We've got some fog patches out there this morning as well, and spells of rain. But for parts of southwest England, it will turn brighter just for a short time, maybe an hour or two. You might get a bit of sunshine, but at least a little change here. But that's before the cloud thickens up again from the southwest, with further heavy rain spreading into the southwest during this evening. And for Wales, it just remains quite cloudy, wet at times through the day. It is mild, though, temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. For southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, it's pretty cloudy with some rain and also a bit of fog as well. Little change for most of the day. But again, for the south Midlands into southeast England, some brighter spells develop later on this afternoon. And actually, that will feel quite pleasant in the sunshine you do get, because temperatures here could reach about 12 or 13 Celsius. But elsewhere, away from that, remaining cloudy. For northwest and northeast England, some mist and fog patches are clearing away. Quite a bit of rain around, especially in northwest England this morning. Can't offer much in the way of any change through the day, with rain continuing on and off and highs of 7 to 11 degrees. And for Northern Ireland and Scotland, another gloomy day. Lots of wet weather around, especially in eastern Scotland and the southwest of Scotland. There'll be some hill snow over the Grampians and the Highlands as well. And maximum temperatures of 3 to 7 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Let's have a first look at this morning's newspapers, shall we? The Guardian says allies of the health secretary, Wes Streeting, expect him to try to depose the prime minister soon, despite his public support for Sir Keir. Its front page says the PM's fragile grip on power is expected to face a challenge within weeks. The Financial Times says loyalists of Sir Keir fear he is too weak to sack Mr. Streeting. A member of the Prime Minister's team has told the paper that doing so would just uncork more chaos of the kind we're trying to avoid.
The Times says that officials are looking at records dating back to Tony Blair's government as part of their investigation into Lord Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The paper notes that they are looking as far back as Peter Mandelson's time as Northern Ireland Secretary between 1999 and 2001. He has denied any wrongdoing.
The Daily Telegraph leads on a double stabbing at a school in northwest London in what it calls an American-style attack. One parent is quoted by the paper as saying he isn't surprised, as most of the kids these days are carrying knives. Daily Mail describes the attack as a rampage. Two boys aged 12 and 13 were left in a serious condition in hospital. A 13-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder.
The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch has accused Labour of a shameful assault on high streets, according to the Daily Express this morning. She says business leaders have told her that higher rates are making it harder to stay afloat. The government says it's providing a £4.3 billion support package to help small businesses thrive.
The Metro's front page focuses on a drug dealer who it calls the Home Alone Menace. That's a reference to the 1980s Macaulay Culkin film. Was it 1980s or 90s? I think it was 80s, wasn't it? The paper says the 60-year-old Ian Clockton rigged his house with booby traps and told the police he was trying to replicate the classic Christmas movie.
It was 1990. Just checked, because you were making me feel old when you said it was 90. So I just very quickly searched it. 1990 was Home Alone. We've got it. 11 minutes past six now.
We have indeed got it. 11 minutes past six. Yes, there's been a dreadful shooting overnight in school shooting in Canada in an area which is very remote, but about 750 miles north of Vancouver. Peter Bowes is our North America correspondent, and I started when I spoke to him a short time ago by asking him what we know so far.
A total of 10 people have died. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police said it received a report of an active shooter at a school in this small town, Tumbler Ridge, population of about 2,400. It lies in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. This is just after lunchtime. A search of the school, 6 people were found dead. A 7th died on the way to hospital. More than 24 people injured. We haven't really had a breakdown in terms of adults or children. The authorities say another person believed to be the attacker was also discovered dead inside the building with what appeared to be a self-inflicted injury. And officials say the shooting at the school and another location, a nearby home, are believed to be linked. 2 bodies were found there. Now, the police say they don't yet know the attacker's connection to the school. There was a community lockdown in the immediate aftermath of this. That has now been cancelled because the authorities say they don't believe that there are any outstanding suspects or any ongoing threats to the public.
And just a little bit about where this is. So British Columbia is on the west of Canada. Vancouver's the major city there. And Tumbler Ridge is this small community about 750 miles north of Vancouver.
Yes, exactly. You've pinpointed it precisely. So it is a tiny town, a small community. And as we know, these kinds of shootings are very rare in Canada. They have taken place in the past, but certainly not as many as you hear about from the United States. So this will have clearly come as a huge shock to people there. We've had some reaction from the British Columbia Premier, David Eby. He said this is a devastating and unimaginable tragedy. He says we can't imagine what the community is going through, but he said, I know it's causing us all to hug our kids a little bit tighter tonight. We've also heard from the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, who said he was devastated by the horrific shooting. He posted on X, he said, my prayers and deepest condolences are with the families and friends who've lost loved ones to these horrific acts of violence.
Peter Bowes, thank you so much for joining us.
It's 13 minutes past six. The government has warned tanning companies not to claim that using sunbeds brings health benefits. Jim Reid is our health reporter. Jim, I remember in days gone by when it was one of the selling points, but that was decades ago. I thought we'd moved on from that now.
It's interesting. There's a definite suggestion that the tanning industry is growing again in the UK. If you look at polling on this, Anna, I think one in seven 18 to 24-year-olds say they use sunbeds over the last year. And there is increasing concern from health groups, dermatologists, cancer doctors about the way in which sunbeds are being marketed online, particularly over the winter. So the Teenage Cancer Trust, for example, say that videos which they would describe as misleading are talking about health benefits of these beds or playing down the risks of skin cancer. We looked into this and found hundreds of videos over the winter that we think would fit that definition of harmful misinformation. One, for example, claimed that doctors prescribe sunbeds for vitamin D deficiency and skin disorders. Another suggested that going on a sunbed for 8 minutes a week could prevent you from getting colds and flu. And these are videos which are widespread, I think it's fair to say, on sites like TikTok and Instagram. Some of these videos are getting tens of thousands of likes on these sites. The Advertising Standards Authority has been concerned about this. It's now banned six tanning ads, online tanning ads, over the last 6 months for making claims it says are irresponsible or misleading, or for playing down what it says are the risks of skin cancer.
Yeah, what is the truth, Jim, of the impact that sunbeds do have on our health?
Well, when you look at what health groups say about this, I think it's fair to say that the likes of doctors, cancer doctors, dermatologists would say they are strongly linked to rising rates of skin cancer. Cancer Research UK, for example, would say that 9 out of 10 melanoma cases in the UK could be prevented by staying safe in the sun or avoiding sunbeds. A Teenage Cancer Trust would advise young people never to use sunbeds whatsoever. The industry association, the Sunbed Association, which represents the industry, would say that those warnings are based on older research and regulation today, regulation which limits the power of sunbeds, which means that under 18 are not allowed to use them. It's illegal for under 18s to use them in the UK, mean that they are safer than they are before. But certainly there are concerns that, like I say, especially over this winter period, some of these health benefits that are being talked about by some of these tanning companies are starting to get through to that younger age group, which may not have picked up those earlier warnings from the 1990s and early 2000s.
Jim Reid, thank you.
It is 16 minutes past six, and here in the studio, not a disembodied voice down the line from Salford, but actually here is the great Sean Farrington with the business news. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Amal. Yes, still a physical human being when in Salford as well. Talking this morning, something that interests you, the world of AI and the impact, the ripple effect across many different industries. And we've seen share prices move a lot in recent weeks as new AI tools get launched by rivals in various markets. Yesterday, we saw the share price of the owners of Money Supermarket down more than 9%. The owners of GoCompare saw its share price down 3%. This was after a new AI tool from an American rival called Insurify made investors think twice. There's been a similar story for traditional American financial brokerages as well in the last day or so, where a new AI tax tool has been launched. Lindsay James is investment strategist at Quilter. Lindsay, morning. What is the thinking here from investors when you see these share price moves?
Well, I think investors are particularly concerned about the disruption from this sorts of tools to the insurance landscape. This is because the new tool in the US allows you to get an insurance quote directly with inside an AI app. Now, we're a long way from that happening in the UK. First of all, this is a paid service in the US. You have to be paying around $20 as a ChatGPT user to access it. But also, even if you were paying in the UK, we're just not there yet. But I think the other factor here is that we have had sort of this sort of thing happening before, not in terms of AI, but in terms of it being easier to access quotes from a broader range of insurance peers, and it hasn't actually destroyed the market. So I think maybe it's just a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction, actually, from investors who are wary about the impact of AI in all sorts of other sectors at the moment and are adjusting their demand for shares more quickly than they are perhaps weighing up the long-term impact on the industry.
Yeah, many trying to figure out what's knee-jerk and what is a long-term major change to an industry. We heard last week Anthropic topic, the AI company launching a new automation tool, included legal, sales, data services. And in the aftermath of that, the value of many companies in the tech world in particular were hit, including Sage, £8 billion company here in the UK on the FTSE 100, our leading stock index. It's a payroll and accounting software giant. Its share price fell by 12% since that tool from Anthropic was launched. Steve Hare joins me now, who is the chief executive of Sage. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What have you had to do in the last week that's any different, given a tool was launched and a share price of your business fell considerably?
Yeah, I mean, I think the market is reacting and sort of putting everyone in the same category. So what we have to do now is just continue to deliver proof points and show why, you know, we're embracing AI very heavily. We have hundreds of engineers working on AI and we're very excited by it. But I think the thing to remember is in accounting, payroll, tax, compliance, nearly just isn't good enough. It has to be very precise. And you have to train your models on the system of records, the payroll, the general ledgers, etc. And that requires domain expertise to combine with the AI. And finally, we need our customers to trust, including not just the accuracy, but the security of the data. So I think over time, the market will figure out the winners and losers. And in the meantime, Sage just continues to demonstrate what it's doing and providing that trust to its customers.
What difference does it make to a big business like yours, Steve? If you have a big, you know, increase in your share price, as many in the tech industry have had, and then over, you know, the course of the last year, you might see it fall 30-40%. How does that change how you run it and what you want to do with the business when the valuation of the whole thing changes so much?
Yeah, it doesn't change how I run it. We have a, you know, very clear strategy. We're focusing on, as I say, providing these services to our customers, which we've done, you know, for 40 years. And as I say, we have hundreds of engineers working on AI, so we're very excited by it. I think what it does change, though, is, you know, you need to focus on communicating, not just to the external world like I'm doing now, but also to your people, to your colleagues, to investors, etc., to reassure them that what you're doing is the right course of action, and that it will just take the market a while to figure out the winners and losers. It's a very disruptive period, and the market will take its time to reach its conclusions.
Do you think those staff are reassured?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, I spend a lot of time communicating to people, and at the same, you know, when the share price was high, I said, don't get carried away. These things are not a straight line journey. And the main thing is to keep focused on customers, keep focused on delivering. And then, you know, over a long period of time, the market always gets it right.
Where do you think in your sector, right, you know, accounting and payroll impacts every business, and as big as Sage are, there are many others involved in providing, you know, those kind of services across the UK. Where do you see the biggest changes and the biggest impact from the advancements in the tools that we're hearing about, you know, week by week, however long it might take for them to kick in?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. I think what AI is bringing is obviously the ability to interact in plain language, so you don't need an IT department to talk to the machine. And what that allows you to do is to use AI to automate repetitive tasks. And accounting and payroll is ideal for that, because there are a lot of things which are repetitive. So what it's doing is it's allowing all of us as humans to focus on the things that that we're good at. And in the case of, we sell to small and mid-sized businesses. You know, small business owners want to spend time running their business, not doing the administrative tasks. And what AI does is allow us to, as I say, automate some of that, but while still giving you the ability to see the audit trail, see how the AI is calculating things. And so building and continuing to trust what's happening in the background whilst you focus on, you know, trying to grow your business.
Are the skills there in small businesses across the UK to be able to use this AI and have the conversations around the issues you're talking about there?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. What we're really focused on is making it as easy to use as possible. I mean, there has been quite a lot of speculation as well about, how much will customers, instead of buying software, will they vibe code and sort of write their own, software? And I think, my answer to that is very much that, people want to spend time running their business, growing their business, and they want us to provide them with things which are easy to use. Mm. But as I say, they trust and they can see how the AI is calculating things.
Are you having to reskill your staff faster than you've known before because of the big changes?
Yeah, two things. One is obviously engineering. So we're, really hiring aggressively people with AI skills, particularly early careers, actually. So younger people who are AI native. And then secondly, obviously, yes, embracing AI internally, whether that be in engineering, where we're using a lot more machine coding, whether it be in marketing, where we can use AI to help us get faster content, etc. So very much changing the way that we operate.
And if you've got 11,000 or so staff worldwide, as I see, do you expect that headcount to reduce because of the automation potential of these tools?
The key is growth. My aim is to continue to grow, say strongly. Recent Q1 results, we grew 10%.
That doesn't mean more staff necessarily.
No, but what it does mean is if we keep growing, what it means is I can reskill staff. I can get them to adopt different jobs, and then hopefully, what happens over time is we grow, but we don't grow jobs in line with that. So, but it is not my focus to reduce that headcount either.
Steve Hare, Chief Executive of Sage, thank you very much for your time this morning. Lindsay, Lindsay James from Quilter, I just wanted to ask about Warner Brothers Paramount. Is this a big development? Paramount going all in, it seems, to try and win over Warner Brothers Discovery. It felt a few weeks ago like Netflix was going to be doing it.
Well, they're trying to sweeten the deal a little bit without actually increasing the amount they're offering for Warner Brothers here. So Ellison has agreed to cover a termination fee that Warner Brothers would have to pay for changing course. So that would be around $1 per share. And they've offered to pay a ticking fee. And this is really an amount that would mean that Warner Brothers investors would be compensated by an extra 25 cents per share in quarterly payments if the deal doesn't close by the end of 2026.
Right.
So, it's small increments here.
Lindsay, thank you for your time this morning. Lindsay James from Quilter. Let's check in with Tom Smith, competition lawyer for Gerardin Partners. He represents app developers who've been challenging Google and Apple's strength in the mobile platform market. Tom, morning to you.
Morning, Sean.
We've seen the Competition and Markets Authority say now that Apple and Google have to commit to reviewing and ranking apps fairly on their app stores. Is this going to change things?
Yeah, these are the kind of first kind of baby steps towards opening up competition in the tech sector a little bit. These first steps are a little bit weaker than were promised. There are no actual legal obligations on Apple and Google that can be enforced by the regulator, but they will make things better. They're going to look at the app review process. They're going to more fairly rank apps in the search function. They're going to reduce the misuse of data, things like this. So
I was going to say, what difference does it make if the EU seems to be the way, has stronger regulations on this than us?
Yeah, that's right. EU consumers already have rights such as the ability to use alternative app stores. US consumers already can complete their payments off platform and therefore avoid Apple's commission. But hopefully these things will come in the UK at some point.
And is it a bit of a running theme, Tom, that decisions, regulations for the big tech companies aren't quite as strong as maybe once thought they might be?
Yes, it is weaker than some on my side of the argument were hoping. I mean, the CMA is operating in a difficult political environment. The US administration's aligning the big tech firms' interests with its own trade policy. Mm. The CMA's chair was sacked by the British government and the ex-head of a big tech firm was put in instead. So it is difficult.
Tom, thank you. Tom Smith there, competition lawyer for Gerardin Partners.
Thank you, Sean. It's 28 minutes past six. Time for the sports news. Jonathan Ledyard's here. Morning.
Good morning. Life gets no easier for the Tottenham manager, Thomas Frank, who watched his team lose 2-1 last night at home to Newcastle United. It's a result that extends Spurs' winless run in the Premier League to 8 matches and led to the manager being booed again at the final whistle.
I understand the frustration, 100%. It's not a good position we're in. You know, how can you say, been building up a little bit. The last season, it was a bit similar, playing Europe and Premier League. This season is a bit similar, Europe and Premier League. So there's something in the squad we need to build their resilience physically and mentally.
They're going to need it because they're fifth bottom in the Premier League, 3 points above the relegation places, but Frank says his job is not under threat. I'm sure they've been very grateful then that Man United scored a stoppage-time equaliser because it prevented West Ham making up ground out of that bottom three. Michael Carrick remains unbeaten as United's caretaker head coach. A 1-1 draw keeps them fourth. But Liam Rossini's winning run as Chelsea manager came to a surprising end last night. They threw away a 2-goal lead against Leeds at Stamford Bridge, ending up with a 2-2 draw. The top three in the table, Arsenal, Manchester City and Aston Villa, all play tonight. Hearts are now 6 points clear at the top of the Scottish Premiership after a late win against their Edinburgh rivals Hibernian, who stay fifth. That was last night. Rangers in second and third place Celtic play tonight. In rugby, captain Maro Itoje is back in the England starting 15 for Saturday's Six Nations match against Scotland in Edinburgh. Itoje was among the replacements for last Saturday's win against Wales. The England coach, Steve Borthwick, has warned against any complacency just because Scotland had that shock defeat by Italy in torrential rain at the weekend.
Those conditions in Italy last Saturday, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. It was difficult for both teams. So I think it's probably to take too much from it is a little bit difficult to do.
England's cricket team for their second match at the T20 World Cup against the West Indies today shows one bowling change from that narrow win over Nepal on Sunday. Surrey's Jamie Overton comes in for Lancashire's Luke Wood. Test match special has commentary from 1:30. More on that match in an hour. And tonight, Team GB are hoping to celebrate their first medal of the 2026 Winter Olympics when figure skaters Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson go for gold in the free dance at 6:30 this evening. They qualified fourth for this second part of the discipline. Remember, they're trying to become Britain's first Olympic figure skating medalist since Jane Torval and Christopher Dean, Torval and Dean, in 1994. That was their comeback. I knew you were going to tell me that.
Jonathan, thank you so much. This weekend, Radio 4 swaps Cupid for comedy.
Valentine's night on Radio 4. No roses, no romance. Just comedy.
Starting with a match made inshallah. I'm Fatia, twice divorced, 44, and I'm looking for my habibi. You'll come on my dates, then hear me roast them on stage. Do you know what I'm saying?
And then Lady Clementine is looking for love.
How do you do? I'm a Regency romantic. I've tried everything, but love simply refuses to knock. I'm attempting modern dating, whatever that may involve.
Radio 4's Valentine's Day comedy specials.
A match made inshallah.
And Lady Clementine is looking for love.
On Saturday night from 11.
It's 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London and Anna Foster in Salford. It's time for a summary of the news. Here's Jane Steele.
At least 9 people have been shot dead and 25 injured in an attack on a school and nearby home in Canada. The suspect was also found dead at Tumbler Ridge Secondary School in British Columbia. According to Canadian media, a police alert sent during the attack described the suspect as a female in a dress with brown hair. A document released in the latest batch of files about Jeffrey Epstein suggests Donald Trump told a police chief in Florida 20 years ago that everyone knew about the paedophile's behaviour. The claim was made in an FBI interview in 2019 with the now former head of Palm Beach Police, who said Mr. Trump called him after an investigation was opened into Epstein. A Justice Department official said they were not aware of any evidence to support that claim. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is meeting President Trump at the White House later. He's expected to urge the US to be tougher in its talks with Iran over the country's nuclear program. A report says last year recorded the second highest number of anti-Semitic incidents in Britain after 2023, when there was a spike following the October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said the government was providing record funding for security at synagogues, Jewish schools and community centres. Police are searching the Arizona home of a person who's been detained over the disappearance of the mother of a US television presenter. Nancy Guthrie was kidnapped from her house in Tucson 10 days ago. Senior managers at the co-op have complained of a toxic culture of the 180-year-old company. A letter to co-op board members says staff are scared to raise concerns about the direction of the business, which has seen falling sales. A Co-op spokesperson said the retailer was in a strong financial position and didn't think the comments were representative.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in the US for talks with President Trump, and Iran is firmly on the agenda. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell can tell us more. Yoland, Israel's position on Iran is well documented. President Trump knows exactly what it is. So what is Benjamin Netanyahu hoping to achieve from these new talks?
I mean, I think he really just hopes to keep up the pressure. Yes, Israel's position is unchanged. It doesn't want just to stop Iran's nuclear program, its uranium enrichment. It sees Iran as the main destabilizing force in the region, so it wants it to stop its support for all its proxies, whether that's Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen. When it comes to its ballistic missile program, Israeli media reports in recent days have said that there is intelligence that will be presented to the White House suggesting that Iran is building up its arsenal again after those 12 days of Israeli strikes last year, which the US joined really targeting Iran's military and nuclear sites. Now, Tehran has already made clear that it rejects those demands made by Israel, that perhaps it would accept some limits on its nuclear program in return for economic sanctions relief, with the economic situation so dire contributing to last month's nationwide protest that led to that bloody government crackdown. Now, we have already seen pictures of the Israeli Prime Minister. He's on his sixth visit to Washington since President Trump returned to office. And he has been sitting down with those key US envoys, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, to get a briefing, basically, on the indirect talks that they've had with the Iranian foreign minister in Iran, Oman, last Friday. He's then set to meet the US Secretary of State later before going off to the White House to meet President Trump. Now, President Trump, for his part, he has been saying, of course, that with this big military build-up already in the region, that he is now actually thinking of sending another second aircraft carrier strike group to the region as well, just to kind of ratchet up the military pressure that bit more.
And what about the topics that, well, should have been on the agenda and probably still will be, but to a lesser extent, things like Gaza? We've seen this week new steps by the Israeli government towards the de facto annexation of the occupied West Bank. How much are they likely to be discussed?
So we have had, Mr. Netanyahu acknowledging in his remarks that, of course, Gaza is on the agenda here. Israel has been continuing to insist that they must see progress when it comes to the disarmament of Hamas. And there have been, these reports in the US media suggesting that the US is coming up with a draft proposal on that that would allow Hamas to keep some small arms for the time being. And when I've spoken to Israeli officials, they say that that is something that they reject. Reconstruction and meeting of the Board of Peace is later on the cards. And that is something that, for domestic politics, Mr. Netanyahu is seeking to play down at the moment. It will be very interesting to see what is said about the West Bank, because last year, President Trump said he wouldn't allow Israel to annex the West Bank. That peace plan that was brokered between Israel and Hamas, it did have some acknowledgement of Palestinian aspirations for statehood, even if that stopped far short of what the Palestinians wanted to see. But that has not, checked the acceleration in Israel's settlements in the West Bank. And we've now had an Israeli minister actually acknowledging, echoing the language of critics about some steps that were announced this week, saying that they will, they're meant to deepen Israeli control in the occupied West Bank, and they do amount to implementing de facto sovereignty.
Yoland Nell, our Middle East correspondent, thank you. At 8:10, by the way, our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Iran. She'll be in the capital, Tehran, and we'll speak to her and hear more about the mood inside the country at the moment.
It's 23 minutes to 7. Let's turn to domestic politics with Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent. Henry, morning. Let's get into this story about Matthew Doyle. It follows tremendous reporting from Gabriel Pogrin in particular at the Sunday Times. It seems that this communications chief for Keir Starmer has been elevated to a peerage, despite the fact that an internal inquiry in Downing Street in December threw up nothing.
Yeah, that's basically right. I mean, this is Matthew Doyle, Lord Doyle, as he is as of last month. He was Sir Keir Starmer's Director of Communications in Downing Street until about a year ago. And as you say, After his appointment to the House of Lords was announced in December, the Sunday Times reported that he had campaigned for a man called Sean Morton in Scotland. He is a former Labour councillor who was charged with possessing and distributing indecent images of children. Matthew Doyle, as he then was, campaigned for him in a council election after he was charged, though before he admitted the offences. Now, Matthew Doyle says, at the point of my campaigning support, Morton repeatedly asserted to all those who knew him his innocence. To have not ceased support ahead of a judicial conclusion was a clear error of judgment for which I apologise unreservedly. Last night, the Labour Party said that Lord Doyle would no longer take the Labour whip in the House of Lords, and they said that they were going to investigate him. But there are, I think, clear questions for Sir Keir Starmer, which I wouldn't be at all surprised if Kemi Badenoch presses at PMQs later today about why he's taking this action now rather than after that reporting in the Sunday Times in December before Lord Doyle took up his seat in the House of Lords.
And Henry, in a week or a fortnight where the Labour Party, at the very top of the Labour Party, has lost Peter Mandelson, it's lost Morgan McSween, it's lost Tim Allen, who worked for Tony Blair in the 1990s, is there a sense, and also Angela Rayner is pictured all over the newspapers, is there a sense in which Keir Starmer is going to come under pressure to tilt more to the left to keep his parliamentary party together?
Yeah, definitely so. I mean, I think things were an awful lot calmer yesterday, and precisely because Labour MPs walked up to the precipice, as Ed Miliband put it memorably, many now seem to have stepped a long way further back from it than they were before. So there isn't a leadership contest now, but what I think there is a subtler contest, which is to define the content of the next phase of Keir Starmer's government. I mean, Ed Miliband, on that media round yesterday morning, was talking on this programme about the Prime Minister needing to be bolder, talking about embracing discussion of class, which he then seemed to do in an event later today, later in the day, Keir Starmer. I mean, I'm actually not sure that the class consciousness is all that new. That's really what the son of a toolmaker line, for which Keir Starmer gets mocked by his opponents, is all about. And he had a riff yesterday about his cabinet being the most working class cabinet in history. Well, that's something we've heard him say proudly before too. But perhaps there was a new emphasis. And I think a lot of this does intersect with those changes in his backroom team that you mentioned, Amol. I mean, it's clearly the case that various of those staff who've departed were, and this is oversimplistic, but they were in Labour Party terms on the right of the Labour Party. Look, I do think this is probably, though, about MPs and what they want and the conditions they set implicitly or explicitly for not walking back to that precipice. They were rapturous about Sir Keir Starmer's performance at the Parliamentary Labour Party meeting on Monday evening. But that doesn't change the fact that there are still potential policy flashpoints coming down the track. I mean, one Labour MP who spoke to me after that PLP meeting said to me, he says he's won every fight he's ever been in. Not true. He's lost every fight he's ever had with the PLP, and that situation is still untenable.
Henry Zeffin, thank you very much indeed.
It's 19 minutes to 7. A 13-year-old has been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder after two boys were stabbed at a school in northwest London. Our correspondent, Vinnie McAvinney, is there. Vinnie, what do we know at this stage?
Well, we understand that police were called yesterday to Kingsbury High School here in northwest London shortly before 1 p.m. to reports from staff members that a 13-year-old boy had been stabbed in a classroom by an attacker who reportedly yelled Allahu Akbar as he stabbed him in the back and the neck. Police arrived at the scene and were informed that a 12-year-old boy had also been attacked. The staff here kept students in the playground whilst police searched the nearby area. After around an hour of searching, they found the 13-year-old suspect and a weapon. They then arrested that individual. The two boys, we understand, have spent the night in hospital. They are said to be in a serious condition. At the school here this morning, police are at the gate. The lower school is going to remain closed, and we understand that police, counter-terrorism police, are leading this investigation, which they say is fast moving, but this has not yet been declared a terrorist incident.
Vinnie McAvinney, thank you for bringing us up to date there.
It's 17 minutes to 7. Just to give you a flavour of a few other things that are around. Yes, just as Vinny was saying there, in this school-stabbing terror probe, the Daily Mail is reporting at the moment that, as you heard there, this terrible attack at Kingsbury High School in Brent. The Daily Mail is reporting that the attacker did scream Allahu Akbar, but that's something that will require further investigation over the course of today. I'll just mention one other story that's on the front of the Times, which is about the investigation into links between Mandelson, Peter Mandelson and Jeffrey Epstein. The Times is reporting this morning that that investigation is going to go back to the Blair era, so a quarter century of Epstein records searched. This huge data dump that we've had from the Department of Justice might just be the beginning of this. We might well get emails going back almost to the turn of the century.
The Guardian leads on politics this morning as well, on Wes Streeting in particular, still intent on deposing PM despite United Front, say, allies. This is the Guardian's reporting team saying that they expect a Wes Streeting leadership bid within weeks, which is interesting because there's a by-election on the way in Gorton and Denton before, of course, local elections in Scotland and Wales due as well in May. And what those timings, that timeline might say about people who want to challenge Keir Starmer. And also as well, worth mentioning the front page of the Daily Telegraph this morning. If you've been following the Winter Olympics, the Daily Telegraph calls it the Olympic cheating scandal you didn't expect. This is one of the athletes, a Norwegian biathlete called Sture Holm Lagerid, who won a bronze medal, but then in his TV interview decided to tell the world that he cheated on his girlfriend, and he thought that by doing it, it might convince her to take him back and show that he was really serious in trying to win her heart. So it was a very different sort of interview after the Winter Olympics, but I'm sure it might get more people watching if they're expecting scandal and intrigue of that type.
I'm just trying to work out who he's hugging on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. Is that
I assume not the girlfriend he cheated on. I think he's hoping that she'll reappear as a result of his pleading and his bronze medal, probably.
That's a great headline. Definitely not the cheating scandal we expected. Right, it is a quarter to seven. There were more questions about Peter Mandelson yesterday in Parliament. A defence minister insisted the former ambassador had not influenced a deal with an American tech giant after the Conservatives asked about the former Labour peer's links to that company. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
The government has promised to harness the power of artificial intelligence, and it's using the technology in courts, hospitals and schools. But ministers also want the armed forces to have access to AI systems. And last year, the Defence Secretary John Healey signed a so-called strategic partnership with Palantir, a US tech company. The deal was agreed a few months after Sir Keir Starmer visited Palantir in Washington with the then British ambassador Peter Mandelson. At the time of the visit a year ago, Lord Mandelson held shares in Global Council, a lobbying company.
At the time of the meeting, was the Prime Minister aware that Palantir was a client of Mandelson's firm? He must answer that.
That was the Shadow Defence Secretary James Cartledge, who'd asked an urgent question about the contracts with Palantir. A Defence Minister, Luke Pollard, said the government was building on the work of the last Conservative government, which had signed an agreement with the US firm in 2022.
As the Defence Secretary has said, the contract was his decision and his decision alone. Peter Mandelson had no influence on the decision to award this contract. The deal we struck with Palantir is going to significantly reinforce the innovation of our forces, and it will reinforce the safety of this country as we move towards warfighting readiness.
James Cartledge said this was a question about transparency.
Given the public interest in this matter, will defence ministers follow the lead of the health secretary and publish all their correspondence with Peter Mandelson? In addition, in the spirit of the humble address, will the government publish all relevant material in relation to this contract award as part of the Mandelson files?
The humble address was the parliamentary mechanism the Conservatives used last week to force ministers to publish relevant documents about Lord Mandelson's appointment as the ambassador to Washington. Luke Pollard repeated that Peter Mandelson had had no influence on the decision to award the contract, and he said the government intended to publish as much material as it reasonably could as soon as possible.
The Cabinet Office is working with the Met Police and the Parliament and Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee to ensure that the release of any documents do not prejudice the Met investigation or the UK's national security and international relations. The process for doing that is underway, in addition to the other actions the Prime Minister has already taken.
The Shadow Defence Secretary said his urgent question was about Peter Mandelson and transparency, rather than Palantir or any other US company. But for other MPs, the firm was the issue. Callum Miller for the Liberal Democrats said Palantir had contracts with the MOD and the NHS worth more than £500 million.
Last month, Donald Trump threatened a NATO ally with annexation. Despite that, the government has chosen to greenlight a multi-million pound defence contract with a company co-founded by Trump's billionaire backer Peter Thiel. We must be alert to the genuine risk that data collected by Palantir in the UK could be fed back to the White House.
And Labour's Clive Lewis said it was time for the government to distance itself from companies associated with President Trump.
This deal with Palantir stinks. It stank and stank before Peter Mandelson was involved. It stank when the benches opposite initiated it into our NHS and defence contracts.
Luke Pollard said he admired his colleague's passion.
But as I've set out to the House, we will continue to maintain a close defence and security relationship with the United States. It is in our national security interest to do so, but in signing any agreement with a US company, just as it would be the case with a French or German or Australian company, we make sure that agreement is in the UK national interest.
But Ellie Chowns of the Green Party insisted that Clive Lewis was right.
The MOD contract with US-based spy tech giant Palantir absolutely stinks. So will the MOD now cancel that contract? Will we get a fast and independent inquiry into the government's contracts with Palantir?
Luke Pollard accused the Greens of being soft on defence, and he told MPs the government would publish information in the right way in due course.
That was Sean Curran reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. It's now 11 minutes to 7.
Senior managers at the Co-op have complained of a toxic culture at executive level of the 180-year-old member-owned food and services group that prides itself on its ethical values. A letter to Co-op board members says that staff are scared to raise concerns about the direction of the business, which has seen falling sales. Our business editor Simon Jack is here to tell us more. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Anna.
This is a bit of a surprise at a business like the Co-op.
Yes, because it traces its roots back to the Rochdale Society of Equitable Pioneers, which was set up and has a very unusual structure and ethos. It's what's known as a mutual business. So rather than being owned by shareholders, it's owned by its nearly 7 million members. And it really distinguishes itself by those values and that structure, which is a big draw to many of its staff and indeed its customers. And its own code of conduct promises an open and supportive working environment. However, several sources have told the BBC that they consider the culture at the very top levels of the business, in their words, a betrayal of those values and toxic. And a letter claiming to represent the views of dozens of managers seen by the BBC, sent to the chair of the overall Co-op board, backed up by other sources I've spoken to, says that some senior managers feel there's a culture of fear and alienation that discourages challenge. It's led to a series of what the letter and several other sources describe as poor decisions that have sapped morale, seen a large number of senior departures and a sharp drop in profits and rising food waste. And one person said, you learn to look at issues these days. Nobody can speak in this business. And a separate source said to me, it's like corporate gaslighting was the way they described it. Top management saying that everything's going fine when all the evidence is to the contrary. And the letter to the members of the board said that many feel decision after decision has been poor, against advice and carelessly communicated.
The Co-op was hit by a major cyber attack last year, wasn't it? So how much of this is a function of that?
Yeah, it was. The Co-op, you may remember, we reported a lot at the time. Last spring, it got hit by a cyber attack. It interrupted trading for weeks. It led to £200 million loss in sales. And the letter says this was actually dealt with pretty well. But some senior managers think, and it's spelled out in the letter, that the subsequent decision to press ahead with this very major restructuring, basically reorganizing the entire food business, damaged the business, confused suppliers, contributed to falling sales. And if you look at the industry benchmarks, they show the Co-op as among the two worst performers in sales growth over the last 6 months. And that can't any longer, in their view, be tied back to the cyber attack last spring. This is a different thing.
And what has the Co-op had to say, Simon?
Well, they said, look, we're in a strong financial position. Debt's come down over the last 5 years. We've got plenty of cash in the bank. We've got significant headroom to face challenges. And they say, look, our culture as a cooperative, ensured decision-making throughout, has listened to views from senior leaders and colleagues. This is their words across our food and wider business. And they say, well, simultaneously acknowledging when a wide range of views are expressed, not everybody will always agree with the final decisions and the actions taken. And lots of people do disagree. There have been a series of high-profile departures. But several people I've spoken to feel nervous of reprisals, feel the current culture at the top at the co-op is, in their words, toxic. You can see the full story on the BBC Business website.
Simon Jagg, our business editor, thank you.
It's 7 minutes to seven. A new study suggests that school teachers are spending a very significant amount of time across the country policing students' use of smartphones. The average size school could be committing more than 100 hours each week to this work and time, which could be spent perhaps more productively doing other things like teaching. Professor Victoria Goodyear is the chief investigator of the Smart School Study at the University of Birmingham and joins us now. Professor Goodyear, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. What have you discovered?
Well, as you suggested, you know, implementing school phone policies in schools is a significant demand on staff time, taking over 100 hours a week. And we looked at this across 20 schools using data from 36 teachers and 20 head teachers or senior leaders in the schools, and really looked at how they're spending their time during the school day. And what we found is that in schools with a permissive policy, so those that allow phones during recreational time at breaks and lunch times, is that they're spending most of their time during the day recording incidents and on staff training and information. And in schools with more restrictive policies, so those typically referred to under a school phone ban, they're spending less time on these activities, but they're spending more time applying behavioural sanctions such as detentions and communicating with parents. And, you know, that amount of time that is being spent is a concern because it could be diverting time away from other well-being promoting activities such as extracurricular clubs, pastoral support or enrichment activities.
Why would a school not just say that all phones need to go in lockers at the start of the day? That's obviously the policy in some schools, but it's not the policy in all schools. We'll get on to whether there needs to be national proposals. But why wouldn't schools just say, no, tough, you can't do it?
Well, that is one option. And in our study, in our study sample, we included three schools with those restrictive types of policies. So that we would say they're inaccessible. So you can either put them in a locker or a pouch or hand into reception. And, you know, it's important to consider that there are different ways of implementing bans.
Yes.
And these are the answers. And with those pouches and lockers, that still comes at a cost. And even with a ban, there'll be breaches that still need to be dealt with. And it's important to consider that, you know, managing phone use in schools does not just relate to put it away or it's related to all the sorts of issues that young people are experiencing on their phones that they tell teachers and they access support from their teachers for that.
And did your research lead you to the view that we need new national rules, in other words, new legislation, national policies to give schools and teachers more support?
What this study tells us is that schools need to be supported to develop new approaches to managing phone use. And schools need support in training and advice to implement these policies without absorbing huge amounts of staff time. And what we provide from this study is kind of a roadmap of where that time is being spent and what the types of issues are. And that can be provided to schools to refine the rules around phone use, the sanctions, the consequences, how they manage it, how they communicate to parents, how they communicate with pupils. So it gives a more developed form of guidance for schools.
So it's interesting, with the whole discussion, which you'll be very mindful of, about smartphone bans and the whole campaign for a smartphone-free childhood, or indeed the social media ban that lots of other countries are bringing in, there is this sense that actually in the end, you can't rely on the tech companies to do it, you can't rely on the parents, they need the help. And there was this feeling that the heavy hand of the state, strong legislation was needed. It's very interesting that so far that's not been the approach of this government when it comes to schools. Is your sense, Professor Goodyear, that teachers, like a lot of parents, do want the heavy hand of the state, or teachers a bit more subtle, and as you say, they think it's about more than just a kind of straightforward ban or no ban?
Well, when we talk to teachers, there is a sense that there needs to be more support in schools for managing phone use. And, you know, broadly, what our study suggests is that when we look at the types of outcomes that phone bans might change or alter or benefit, we actually find that there's no difference between schools that restrict phone use and permit phone use on mental health outcomes, cognitive outcomes, attainment, behaviour, that sort of thing.
Right.
Okay. And what the study tells us is that we need to be addressing this issue overall, and schools can't be an isolated context to dealing with all the mental health harms that can be experienced from phones.
And all the issues that come in. Yeah. Professor Victoria Goodyear, very interesting. Thank you very much for joining us.
Looking ahead to this evening on Radio 4, we're getting closer to the truth in the Archers.
Mum, I'm sorry.
What happened in Ambridge on New Year's Eve?
Do you remember when I first woke up? Did I say anything about who attacked me?
You were still very woozy.
Was it me who said it had to be Marky's gang? Or was it you or Amber?
Why are you asking?
Something ain't quite right.
Who attacked George? Discover the truth this week in The Archers, every night at 7 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
2 minutes to 7, here's Simon King with the weather.
Amol, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. We start off this morning on a rather cloudy note again across the United Kingdom. Some areas of rain as well. But for southwest England and Wales, the rain is quite light and patchy this morning, so it's nothing too significant. And we may even start to see a bit of sunshine developing just for a short time, maybe 1 or 2 hours around parts of southwest England into the afternoon. That will be ahead of the cloud thickening with further heavy rain spreading in from the southwest. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 9 to 12 degrees. For southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, again, pretty cloudy. We've got some rain around this morning. Little change for most of the day, but for the south Midlands into southeast England, there may be a few brighter spells developing this afternoon, and with temperatures of 9 to 13 degrees, that will feel quite pleasant where that sunshine does actually come through. For northwest and northeast England, cloudy, some mist, some fog patches, quite a lot of rain, especially in the northwest of England this morning. Can't offer much in the way of change, really, with rain continuing on and off throughout the day, highs of 7 to 11. And for Scotland and Northern Ireland, another gloomy day, a lot of rain around, especially in the eastern and southwestern areas of Scotland. Little change into the afternoon, some hill snow as well, 3 to 7 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of February. The headlines. 9 people have been killed and 25 injured in a school and nearby home in Canada in one of the deadliest shootings in the country's history. An FBI document released in the US says Donald Trump told a senior police officer 20 years ago that everyone knew what Jeffrey Epstein had been doing. A report says there was a spike in anti-Semitic incidents immediately after the deadly attack on a synagogue in Manchester last October.
To come in the next hour of the programme, the government wants all secondary schools to have a dedicated special educational needs base, but is the money there to actually provide them? We'll discuss that with the schools minister at 10 to 8 and Ian Rankin on the book that first ignited his love of reading and really sparked his career as a writer, Muriel Sparks, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
It's a bit of a TARDIS. It's much bigger on the inside than the outside. It's tragic, it's funny, it's clever, it's dramatic. It's about growing up, demagoguery, it's about the rise of fascism. It's many, many things in one small compartment.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
At least 9 people have been shot dead and 25 injured at a school and nearby home in British Columbia in what Canadian officials have described as one of the worst mass shootings in the country's history. Police say the suspected shooter was found dead at the school. According to Canadian media, an alert sent during the attack described the suspect as a female in a dress with brown hair. The Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has called the killings horrific and cancelled a planned trip to the Munich Security Conference. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police said it received a report of an active shooter at a school in the small town of Tumbler Ridge, which lies in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, shortly after lunchtime. During a search of the school, 6 people were found dead, while a 7th died on the way to hospital. The authorities say another person, believed to be the attacker, was also discovered dead inside the building, with what appeared to be a self-inflicted injury. Officials say the shooting at the school and at a nearby home where 2 bodies were found are believed to be linked. The police say they don't yet know the attacker's connection to the school. A community lockdown was cancelled after the authorities said they didn't believe there were any outstanding suspects or ongoing threats to the public.
A document released in the latest batch of files about Jeffrey Epstein suggests Donald Trump told a police chief in Florida 20 years ago that everyone knew about the paedophile's behaviour. The claim was made in an FBI interview in 2019 with the now former head of Palm Beach Police, who said Mr. Trump called him after an investigation was opened into Epstein. A Justice Department official said they were not aware of any evidence to support that claim. Adam Gocha reports.
The document is a written record of a 2019 FBI interview with the former police chief in Palm Beach, who claims that Mr. Trump called him after the department launched an investigation into Epstein and said, "Thank goodness you're stopping him. Everyone has known he's been doing this." The officer's name is redacted, but the document identifies him as Michael Reiter, who, according to the Miami Herald newspaper, has confirmed that the conversation with Mr. Trump happened in July 2006, when he was the chief of police. The FBI's summary of the interview says Mr. Trump told him he'd thrown Epstein out of his Mar-a-Lago club and that people in New York knew he was disgusting. Asked by reporters in 2019, when Epstein was arrested by federal agents for sex trafficking, if he had any suspicions about the disgraced financier, Mr. Trump said, "No, I had no idea," adding, "I haven't spoken to him in many, many years."
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to push the US to be tougher in its nuclear talks with Iran when he meets President Trump at the White House later. The negotiations restarted last week against the backdrop of a large American military build-up in the region. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell.
As he has so often in his long political career, Benjamin Netanyahu will be pushing for a tougher US stance against Iran. Last year, Washington joined Israel as it carried out 12 days of strikes on Iran's nuclear and military sites. But now, with the US returning to diplomatic talks, Israel insists that Tehran must not only stop all uranium enrichment, it must also cut its ballistic missile program and support for armed groups across the Middle East. Tehran has repeatedly rejected such demands, suggesting it's ready to limit its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. For his part, President Trump has sought to add to the military pressure on Iran, telling journalists that he's considering adding to his naval armada in the region by sending a second US aircraft carrier.
A report says 3,700 anti-Semitic incidents were recorded in Britain last year, the second highest annual total after 2023, the year of the October the 7th attack on Israel by Hamas. The figures were compiled by the Community Security Trust, which monitors incidents of anti-Jewish hate. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, described the numbers as shocking and said the government was providing record funding for security at synagogues, Jewish schools and community centres. Here's our religion editor, Ali Mukbul.
Last year was the second worst in terms of anti-Semitic incidents in Britain since the Community Security Trust, or CST, started recording such data in 1984. 2025 had the first deadly anti-Semitic attack during those 42 years when, on Yom Kippur in October, two people were killed and three seriously injured at the Heaton Park synagogue in Manchester. But what the CST's reporting also shows is that there was a spike in anti-Semitic incidents recorded in the immediate aftermath of that synagogue attack, in some cases involving what the organisation calls face-to-face taunting and celebration of the attack to Jewish people.
US officials investigating the disappearance of a television news presenter's mother in Arizona say they have detained a person of interest. The announcement follows the release of video footage showing a masked man at Nancy Guthrie's front door in Tucson. From there, David Willis reports.
A statement from the local sheriff's department says its officers detained an individual during a traffic stop, and that person is being questioned in connection with Nancy Guthrie's disappearance. A search of premises associated with the individual is also taking place. 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie went missing from her home here 10 days ago, and the news that a suspect had been detained came only hours after the FBI released security camera pictures of a masked individual tampering with the camera at her front door around the time of her disappearance. A ransom note emailed to media outlets demanded $6 million in Bitcoin in return for Mrs. Guthrie's release.
Britain is to double the number of troops deployed in Norway to 2,000 over the next 3 years as part of a NATO mission to defend the Arctic. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, says Russia poses the biggest threat to the security of the region since the Cold War. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell.
NATO allies may have persuaded Donald Trump last month not to invade Greenland, but they did agree the island and wider region needed better protection from Russia and China. So planning is underway for a new NATO mission called Arctic Sentry. John Healey is expected to confirm today that UK forces will take part. He and other NATO defence ministers will discuss the plans in Brussels tomorrow. Arctic Sentry is expected to involve greater surveillance and military exercises in the region with an enhanced air and maritime presence.
MPs are pushing for the government to refurbish or replace England's crumbling school buildings rather than relying on short-term fixes, warning that pupils' learning is being affected. The Education Select Committee also says that significant concerns remain about aerated concrete, known as RAC, despite progress being made towards removing it from schools. The government agreed too many school buildings weren't fit for purpose while setting out its vision to improve them for the next decade. Our education reporter Hayley Clark has the details.
The MP's report says significant progress has been made in removing the lightweight concrete RAC from schools since the discovery that it posed a risk to hundreds of buildings. But it notes that some students are still relying on temporary classrooms. The committee calls for longer-term funding commitments for school repairs, with a move from fixes to upgrades and rebuilds. The government said it wanted to end the cycle of patching with its announcement of a 10-year plan for school buildings. This includes proposals to make schools greener and more inclusive by design.
Senior managers at the Co-op have complained of a toxic culture of the 180-year-old company. A letter to Co-op board members says staff are scared to raise concerns about the direction of the business, which has seen falling sales. A Co-op spokesperson said the retailer was in a strong financial position and didn't think the comments were representative.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past seven. Let's go straight to our lead story this morning. There has been this dreadful shooting in British Columbia in Western Canada. It's possibly the worst, or certainly one of the worst shootings in that country's history. 9 people have been confirmed dead, 25 injured. 6 victims were found dead inside a secondary school called Tumbler Ridge. Tumbler Ridge is a very small community, around 2,000 people. It's about 750 miles north of the city of Vancouver in British Columbia. And we can go now live to Tumbler Ridge, where we can speak to Chris Norbury, whose wife is a teacher at the school. Mr. Norbury, good morning.
Good morning, hello.
Well, certainly not good morning, sorry, that's an inappropriate phrase to use, but thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. We hugely appreciate it. Sorry to ask you to do this, but obviously you are much closer to the incident than us, and perhaps tell us a little bit more than we already know. Could you just tell us a little bit about how the last few hours have unfolded? When did you first hear that there had been this dreadful attack?
So I first heard when I got a call from my daughter's elementary school that they were on lockdown.
And that was that's a different school to the school where the shooting was.
Yeah, so that's their elementary school, and the incident happened at the high school. So I got a call from the elementary school saying they're on lockdown. My daughter is safe. Then I immediately texted my wife, who is a teacher at the high school where this tragedy took place.
And what did she tell you about what happened?
She did not respond. So I got up, and I work across the street from the high school. I can see the roof of the building, and I saw emergency personnel on the streets blocking the entrance. And this was during when normally school gets out, so there's people coming to pick up the children, and so there's quite a bit of confusion as that was blocked off, and that is a strong indicator that there is a serious incident happening at the point in time. At that point, so we were just able to see, you know, police vehicles coming, all sorts of police vehicles. I mean, we have 3 police vehicles in town. We're a very, very small community, and we definitely saw police vehicles coming from out of town. You know, I got a call because I worked at the visitor center about a police helicopter coming in to bring in special units. There was all types of reports on social media and texts, and a lot of misinformation being spread. It was a very scary time, not knowing what was going on, being afraid for our community. We're a very small community.
Is your wife okay?
Yes, she's home. Okay. We're all home. We're together.
And there, as you say, there's a huge amount of information, misinformation. It's very early stages, as ever with these dreadful attacks. Social media is not a place to go for verified information. Have you heard anything, Mr. Norbury, about the perpetrator, the shooter itself, anything at all, any other details about that person?
I'm sorry, I can't share that information. You know,
Sure.
You know, like we're a very small community, as I said. We know each other. We all know each other. We all know the victims. Like they're our friends. They're our friends' children. You know, we're very, very close. We're one big family here. And you know, unfortunately, like it's a big tragedy. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a shocking thing for a small community. Just tell us, if you would please, about Tumbler Ridge. It's a place that many of our listeners won't know. Many might know Vancouver, which is 750 miles or 12 hours to the south. Tell us a bit about Tumbler Ridge.
You know, we're a small community in northeastern British Columbia, which is northwestern Canada. You know, it's an incredibly safe community. You know, people don't lock your doors. Our cars aren't locked. We don't have to worry about crime here. So this is such an unbelievable tragedy that has happened here, because it's not something that you would ever think would happen.
And what's the scene in Tumbler Ridge now? There must be a huge amount of not just national and international media, but also emergency services and forensics doing their work.
Well, you know, the high school is still an active crime scene. So they are investigating. You know, speaking with the mayor, you know, we will be receiving, you know, support in terms of counseling and all those sorts of things, what we need to get through this very tragic time. You know, and for the teachers, for the families, you know, and especially the first responders, you know, the first responders, the teachers that have had to witness, you know, their friends, their friends' children and go through this tragedy, that have been injured, that have lost their lives. It's a hard thing.
Well, we hugely, hugely appreciate your taking the time to bring us up today. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Mr. Norbury. That's Chris Norbury, who lives in Tumbler Ridge, whose wife is a teacher at the school where this attack took place. Let's turn now to Kerry Lynn Findlay, who's a former Member of Parliament for South Surrey White Rock, a constituency in British Columbia. She's now running to become leader of the British Columbia Conservative Party. Ms. Findlay, I'm going to say good morning again, but morning from London.
Yes, morning there, evening here.
Evening where you are. Thank you so much for joining us. This is obviously a hugely shocking case. We hear very, very often about these awful, awful, awful shootings in America, but it's not very often that we hear about them in Canada, is it?
No, it isn't. And it is devastating, as you could hear in Mr. Norbury's voice, the shock in a small community of so many dying and being severely injured. This high school has about 160 students in it. You've got a town of about 2,400. Virtually everybody knows everybody, and that would include the first responders and the RCMP, who were there very, very quickly, but came upon a devastating scene. And the investigation is ongoing, but this is something that British Columbians and Canadians won't soon get over. There's no doubt.
Of course. And it's no doubt too soon to talk about, you know, dramatic policy changes or legislation. But can you just give us a sense, please, Ms. Findlay, of how active a discussion there is in Canada around the issue of gun control? That's obviously a very live issue in America. Is there public concern in Canada about whether or not you've got the right rules in place?
There is active discussion, but the vast, vast majority of violent crime in Canada, and of course we're not immune to it, is from, in the criminal element, it's people who smuggle guns in, often, you know, take the serial numbers off. We don't have a problem with normally law-abiding gun owners. We do have a active outdoor hunting, fishing, and angling population here, particularly in the northern parts of the country that tend to be more rural. So it is an ongoing debate, because there is federal legislation where they're trying to buy back certain types of firearms from citizens who are resisting. And some provinces have said they simply won't cooperate with that federal edict. So yes, it's an active political discussion. But really, when something like this happens, we're just all our thoughts and prayers with these folks who live in Tumbler Ridge who, as he said, know the victims, they know their children, they know each other. So it's a very, very tough time.
Yes, indeed. Kerry Lynn Finley, thank you very much, Steve, for joining us on a very difficult evening in Canada.
It's 17 minutes past seven now. A former police chief in the US state of Florida says he received a phone call from Donald Trump 20 years ago, telling him that everyone knew about Jeffrey Epstein's offending behavior. He was investigating Epstein at the time over the sexual exploitation of girls in Palm Beach when the now president contacted him to say something very different to the "I had no idea" comment that he made to reporters in 2019. Our North America correspondent Anthony Zerker has been telling me more.
Right. This is a document that has been found in the millions of pages released in the latest tranche of Epstein files by the Justice Department. It's a report that the FBI filed in October 2019, a couple months after Jeffrey Epstein died, an interview with a police chief in Palm Beach who was recounting a phone call he got while he was conducting his investigation into Epstein back in July 2006. Now, Donald Trump apparently called this police chief because he learned about the investigation. And he told the police chief, according to the chief, "Thank goodness you're stopping him." He said, "Everyone's known that Epstein has been doing this." And he also said to focus the investigation on Ghislaine Maxwell, who was the convicted accomplice of Epstein's. Donald Trump called her evil.
And there is particular attention on really any moment, any document, any point at which President Trump appears in these files.
Absolutely. And this in particular undercuts some of what Donald Trump has said about when he knew Epstein was engaged in this sex trafficking ring, when he knew that Epstein was engaged in crimes, even as late as 2018, 2019. Donald Trump was saying he didn't have any idea of Jeffrey Epstein's activities. It also calls into question Trump's view of Ghislaine Maxwell, calling her evil in this phone call, according to the police chief. But then when Maxwell was arrested in 2021, I believe, he said that he wished her well. So the White House has released a comment saying this does substantiate Donald Trump saying that he didn't like Epstein and that he didn't want to have anything to do with him. But it also casts some questions about what Donald Trump knew and when he knew it.
And even though we're approaching 2 weeks now since this latest huge tranche of files was released, and all the time we are seeing new elements come out of it.
Absolutely. It's millions of pages, and it does take an enormous amount of time to go through it. So reporters and individuals, private citizens, have been accessing this, and they find new things every day. Now, throw into that the fact that members of Congress now can go to the Justice Department and access the unredacted files, and they have spotted things that shouldn't have been redacted, names that should have been made public, and they've already gotten the Justice Department to reveal some more information. And they're doing this based on their own information. They're doing this based on tips that they're getting from private citizens. It just seems like this story, even if it seemed like the Justice Department wanted to close the books on it, isn't going to end. New information is going to keep coming out.
Anthony Zerker in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
21 minutes past seven, and Sean is here with Business. Hi, Sean.
Hello. I'm all talking AI again this time. Where's the money coming from to pay for all of this investment, particularly at a massive tech company like Google, who have decided to attempt to take on a 100-year loan and persuade investors to lend them money for that period of time, something that would usually be done by governments, not businesses. Yet this company, not yet 30 years old, has decided to do the same. It's raising billions of dollars, Google's parent company, Alphabet, taking on a lot more debt to try and pay for some of that AI investment that we've talked so much about. I've got Eddie Trull with me, who's the former chairman of the London Pension Fund Authority, and actually whose late brother Danny Trull was heavily involved with the health research charity Wellcome Trust, having a similar 100-year bond, as it's called in the investment world, previously. Eddie, thanks for joining us. Why would somebody lend to a company like Google for 100 years? Who would do that?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? So Google are raising about $30 billion in the bond markets. They're borrowing about $30 billion in American dollars, in sterling, probably in Swiss francs as well. Google, or Alphabet, is actually more highly rated than the UK government. So investors think that they are a better long-term bet than lending to the UK.
Now, they're also doing this 100-year loan or bond in particular.
Yes.
They've done it in pounds sterling as well. Why do you think they would choose to do that in pounds? They're raising lots of money in dollars, of course, too.
Yes. So, two thoughts. Firstly, in the UK, pensions and pension insurers, like my old shop, Pension Insurance Corporation, have taken on an awful lot of very long-dated liabilities. Think of a young person joining a pension fund today. You may have to be paying a pension to them in 70, 80 years' time. They need to find assets, bonds, that are of a similar, very long, what's called duration, or very long period of paying interest to the pension insurer. And so they are very keen to buy extremely long bonds. 100 years is amazing, isn't it? To match their liabilities. And that's what they want to do, is match up. We've got a very deep pension insurance market here in the UK. It's the deepest in the world, and Alphabet are tapping into that market for our pension savings.
Eddie, just very briefly, is this big tech companies behaving like governments increasingly?
As I say, they're better rated than the UK government. They're raising more money for a very, very long period than the UK government. And in some ways, they're betting against the British economy. By borrowing in pounds, investing in dollars, they found it really difficult to actually build data centers and so on in the UK. So they're borrowing the money in a very deep market,
right,
and they're taking that money off to America and elsewhere to actually invest it into data centers.
Eddie Chaul, former chairman of the London Pension Fund Authority, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sean.
Not at all.
24 minutes past seven. Since the turn of the year, we've been celebrating here on the programme the fact that it is the National Year of Reading, and we've heard from some of the best known and some of the best loved authors in the country about the books that maybe ignited or reignited their love of reading. And today, it is the turn of Ian Rankin, the Gold Dagger winning crime writer known for the Inspector Rebus novels, and he has chosen The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie by Muriel Spark, first published in 1961 by Macmillan.
The book I've chosen is The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which I read when I was in high school. I remember buying it from a local bookshop for 50p. I began reading it and it was completely captivating. It's a very short book, which is great, but it's also a huge book. It's a bit of a TARDIS. It's much bigger on the inside than the outside. It's tragic, it's funny, it's clever, it's witty, it's dramatic, it's about growing up, it's about demagoguery, it's about the rise of fascism. It's many, many things in one small compartment. It's a novel that's written by a poet or someone who regarded herself as a poet. If you go to Muriel Spark's grave in Italy, it just says poeta on it. It doesn't say novelist. And it has that intensity. She makes a few words do an awful lot of work. So you can go back and reread it. And I have gone back and reread it many, many, many times. And every time I read it, I find something new, something fresh that I hadn't noticed before. It led me to doing my PhD thesis on the novels of Muriel Spark. That's how much of an influence this book was on me. And I was doing my PhD thesis in Edinburgh and then decided myself I should write about Edinburgh. And so that led to me becoming a crime writer. There's a short reading from near the beginning of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. At that time, they had been immediately recognisable as Miss Brodie's pupils, being vastly informed on a lot of subjects irrelevant to the authorised curriculum, as the headmistress said, and useless to the school as a school. These girls were discovered to have heard of the Buckmanites and Mussolini, the Italian Renaissance painters, the advantages to the skin of cleansing cream and witch hazel over honest soap and water, and the word menarch. The interior decoration of the London house of the author of Winnie the Pooh had been described to them, as had the love lives of Charlotte Bronte and of Miss Brodie herself. They were aware of the existence of Einstein and the arguments of those who considered the Bible to be untrue. They knew the rudiments of astrology, but not the date of the Battle of Flodden or the capital of Finland. All of the Brodie set, save one, counted on its fingers, as had Miss Brodie, with accurate results, more or less. That section is interesting because it is setting up everything. It's setting up the pull that Miss Jean Brodie has over her girls. The fact that they may at some point, because they are being made into free thinkers, then want to pull away from her. The school versus the teaching system, the unusual teaching system. Most of us, when we were at school, had one teacher who was charismatic and who stood out from the rest and maybe pushed against the rules and regulations. And that all comes in there. She can have a lightness of touch. Her books, if you look at the quotes on the back, are often described as being light and witty and bubbling. And yet, there is this darkness at the heart of all of them. All of that story of growing up in the innocence, the awkwardness, the flowering, and in some cases the deflowering, all of that is in the book. But then when you scratch the surface, you find the darkness just waiting for you.
Wow, wonderful. Ian Rankin. It is 28 minutes past seven, and Jonathan Legard is here with the sport. Hi, Jonathan.
Morning again. The Tottenham manager, Thomas Frank, says his job is not in danger despite last night's home defeat by Newcastle, which leaves them winless in eight in the Premier League, fifth bottom in the table, just 5 points above the relegation places. And the next match is the North London derby against the league leaders. Man United and Chelsea lost ground on the top leaders by drawing against West Ham and Leeds respectively. But in Scotland, Hearts extended their lead at the top to 6 points after winning the Edinburgh derby 1-0 last night. Rangers and Celtic play tonight. Meanwhile, this afternoon, Harry Brooks, England, and cricket team play their second match in Group C at the T20 World Cup against the West Indies, well aware they need to improve on their last performance when they squeezed past Nepal by just 4 runs. Now, during that match, the England coach Brendan McCullum was seen relaying matches from the dressing room to the pitch via a walkie-talkie, and the wicketkeeper Joss Butler was saying in the build-up to the game that cricket is lagging behind other sports with innovation and on-field coaching. Well, let's talk to the former England fast bowler Stephen Finn about this ahead of the match. Morning, Stephen.
Yes, good morning.
How much would you welcome input as a player from a coach as well as a captain during a match?
Yeah, well, look, we are in an age where you need as much information as possible when you're out there on the pitch, and the way that England are choosing to relay it is relatively new. I mean, it has been done before, but it's not widely used across the game. And actually, I think the vantage point that the coach has in the dressing room, which is elevated and set back from the pitch, actually gives him a better view of what's going on the ground sometimes than the people who are directly involved in the game. So, all information is welcome, and it's just up to you as a player to decipher it.
Walkie-talkies on Sunday, but maybe earpieces soon, do you reckon? Do you see what I mean? You're developing more and more.
Absolutely. I think you're not allowed that direct communication from the captain to the coach, but teams have often tried to relay messages, and the quicker that you can do that, the better. So maybe it's earpieces next.
Is this an example of more active management by the coach, Brendan McCullum, after such a bruising Ashes series when he was criticised heavily for various things which didn't go well?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think at the end of that series, Brendan McCullum said that he was willing to evolve as a coach. He wouldn't go away from his principles of what he truly believed in and what he thinks gets the best out of players. But he said he was willing to innovate and challenge the way that he'd done it before and reflect on that. And I think this is one of those manners in which he has reflected on that. And he's got such an excellent cricket brain that it would be a waste for the team not to use it whilst they're out on the pitch. So it's good to see them adapting, and they'll be mighty relieved they got over the line the other day.
And on that point, what are you looking for England to be sharper for today's match?
Well, I think none of their big players, or not none of them, but you look at Salton Butler at the top of the order, which is a real positive for England. That partnership didn't fire. And then with the ball, Adil Rashid and Jofra Archer both had off days, which is unusual for the both of them to have an off day on the same day. So, I'm sure there'll be a sharpening of the mind coming into this game, and I think that will stand them well.
Stephen, thank you very much indeed. We'll look forward to hearing more from Stephen as part of Test Match Special on air from 1:15, 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. Afghanistan need 188 to beat South Africa in Group D. Currently they're 33 without loss. And in the next hour, we'll be talking to Robin Cousins ahead of the figure skating final with Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson aiming for Team GB's first medal of the Games.
Oh yes, lots to look forward to. Thank you, Jonathan. It's time for a preview of a star-studded drama that's coming up on Radio 4 this weekend.
Someone beautiful has left our lives.
Drama on BBC Radio 4.
I've never understood why she divorced me, but I can see why she got shot of him.
Nicholas Le Prevost, Jonathan Pryce and Bill Paterson star as three men toasting old memories.
Paula was braver than all of us.
And reopening old wounds.
You stole my wife, you broke up my marriage. I went through agony.
Nobody can break up a marriage that isn't broken to start with. We all know that.
I Remember You. This Saturday afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
A quick look at the weather. It's a cloudy and damp start today with patchy rain, but it will clear across the afternoon, leaving isolated showers, but staying breezy and mild.
We're going to talk a bit more about that rain after the news. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Jane Steele has a summary of the news.
At least 9 people have been killed in a mass shooting at a school and nearby home in a remote part of Canada. Police say the suspect was also found dead at the secondary school in Tumbler Ridge in British Columbia. According to Canadian media, an official alert sent to people's phones during the attack described the suspect as a female in a dress with brown hair. A document released in the latest batch of files about Jeffrey Epstein suggests Donald Trump told a police chief in Florida 20 years ago that everyone knew about the paedophile's behaviour. The claim was made in an FBI interview in 2019 with the now former head of Palm Beach Police, who said Mr. Trump called him after an investigation was opened into Epstein. A Justice Department official said they were not aware of any evidence to support that claim. The president has previously said he had no idea about Epstein's crimes. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to urge President Trump to be tougher in its nuclear talks with Iran during their meeting at the White House later. The negotiations restarted last week against the backdrop of a large American military build-up in the region. A report says 3,700 anti-Semitic incidents were recorded in Britain last year, with a spike immediately after the deadly Manchester synagogue attack 4 months ago. The Community Security Trust, which monitors anti-Semitism, says it's the second highest annual total after 2023, the year of the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said the government was providing record funding for security at synagogues, Jewish schools and community centres. Britain is to double the number of troops deployed in Norway to 2,000 over the next 3 years as part of a NATO mission to defend the Arctic. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, says Russia poses the biggest threat to the security of the region since the Cold War. The plans are expected to involve greater surveillance and military exercises in the region, with an enhanced air and maritime presence.
Thank you, Jane. It's 26 minutes to 8. It is raining again. We've talked on the programme several times this week about how it's been the wettest start to the year on record, and there is still no respite in sight. Around 100 parts of the country still have flood warnings in place. It is pretty miserable, frankly, isn't it? But the impact goes beyond just our mood. There is a lot of damage that's being caused by the excess water as well. Jack Stevenson farms in Banff in Scotland. Morning, Jack.
Morning, Anna. How are you?
Oh, I'm all right. I'm coping. How are you? More to the point, I bet it's miserable where you are.
It is. It's raining again here up in the northeast, and it just every single day is the same. We've not seen the sun for about 20 days, I think, since the beginning of the year. That's us up to about 250 to 280 mil of rain in certain parts of Aberdeenshire. So, yes, I wish it was cheerier, but it isn't.
What have you got on your farm that you're trying to just salvage at the moment, I suppose?
Well, we've got winter wheat, winter barley and some winter oilseed rape. I mean, any areas that is lying underwater, any low-lying areas, 3 or 4 days and that crop just dies. I mean, if the rain does keep up like this, it's going to have a severe impact on yield and quality come harvest time. But we're always reasonably optimistic. You think, well, surely into middle of February, it's spring will be in the air, but it doesn't seem to be at the moment, Hannah.
No, it's difficult, isn't it? And I realise this is very much a non-farmer's question, but there's nothing you can do. You can't sort of drain. It's just out of your hands, is it, once it gets as bad as that?
Well, and I mean, there's certain areas near rivers. Yes, there's more river work could be done, dredging rivers and water management for flood prevention in the future. But we do drain a lot of our land. I mean, it's a very expensive way, but the kind of trying to deal with the climate and what is a normal weather pattern. So maybe last year it was drought and this year it seems to be flood. So we do as much as we can to prevent these things, to take the water off the surface of the crops. But sometimes it's just out with our hands.
Yeah, you just never can tell. Well, good luck with it, Jack. I appreciate you talking to us this morning. Thank you. That is Jack Stevenson in Banff in Scotland, an experience being replicated up and down the country really at the moment. I've been speaking to Julie Foley, who's the Director of Flood Risk Strategy and National Adaptation at the Environment Agency, and asked her really to set out the impact that all of this rain is having.
Well, there has just been relentless rain since the beginning of the year. Some parts of the country have seen rain every single day. We've also seen areas like the southwest over January, for instance, receive about 80% more rain than is normal for that time of year. And that's why we've seen such significant impacts in areas like the Somerset Levels, for example, where there have been hundreds of properties flooded and significant swathes of farmland as well. And some of our biggest river systems, like the Thames, for example, the Ouse in Yorkshire, the Trent, the Severn, are all what we describe as bankfull, which means that they're right at the top of the riverbank levels now. So we're needing to be really very exceptionally vigilant because the ground is now so very, very saturated.
Are you, as the Environment Agency, doing everything that you can to try and help people deal with some of the impact of that?
The Environment Agency is fully operational. So we're thinking about how we can deploy our pumps when needed, our temporary barriers. We're clearing channels so they can drain water as quickly as possible from river channels. And we're obviously using our defences around the country. So we are ready to respond to events that could happen anywhere around the country with our emergency services. I think it's worth bearing in mind that whilst the southwest have had, for example, some quite significant flood impacts, as I mentioned, several hundred properties have been flooded. 16,000 properties have also been protected thanks to the investments we have been making in defences in recent years, which is really showing the dividend of the investments we've been making in flood resilience.
We've heard some concerns as well. We heard from a farmer on the programme earlier this week about things that used to be done, the cutting back around smaller rivers, the maintenance, particularly in places like the Somerset Levels, which doesn't happen anymore. And that will undoubtedly make a difference.
Well, we work really closely with farmers and land managers and what's called internal drainage boards, particularly in areas like Somerset, but also other low-lying areas, to make sure that we are planning our maintenance so we can clear channels when we know there's going to be flooding expected. The other really important thing we're doing, which we always do, is work really closely with the Met Office through the Flood Forecasting Centre to make sure that when flooding is expected, we give people timely flood warnings so they can take action to prepare as soon as possible.
Julie Foley, the Director of Flood Risk Strategy and National Adaptation at the Environment Agency. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's just coming up to 7:40. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be in the US for talks with President Trump later today. They'll be discussing, in the main, the situation in Iran, with the US still poised to strike, even as negotiations about the future of the Iranian nuclear program are going on. Donald Trump said Israel also wants a good deal, but when Mr. Netanyahu flew out, he commented only that he would present to the president, i.e. Mr. Trump, our outlook regarding the principles of these negotiations. Anshel Pfeffer is Israel correspondent for The Economist and biographer of Netanyahu, joins us now. Anshel, good morning.
Good morning, Alan.
What does Netanyahu want?
Netanyahu wants to see a deal that doesn't just include the nuclear file, because until now the focus has been on the nuclear program in talks, but much of Iran's nuclear program was severely damaged back in the war in June, and now it's much easier for Iran to concede on that. However, there are other issues such as Iran's arsenal of long-range ballistic missile and its funding for various proxy movements in the region like Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis. And Netanyahu wants any deal that Trump reaches with Iran to include limitations on that as well.
So will he push Trump to prioritize the disarmament of Hamas over the reconstruction of Gaza?
Well, there is a question of how much Gaza will be on the agenda.
Yes,
Trump
exactly.
Does seem very much to be wedded to his Board of Peace vision, and the Board of Peace is meeting next week in Washington, and Netanyahu probably won't be there. And Israel is saying that the disarmament has to as you said, be prioritized and come before reconstruction, whereas Trump and his team seem to think it can somehow be simultaneous. So the thing I will probably also be urging him on this, but I think Iran is still very much at the top of the agenda.
You've been writing a lot for The Economist, Anshul, on this this relationship between these two men, similar age, similar generation, perhaps similar outlook. Is Trump, is Gaza in Israel something that Trump really owns, or does he outsource that issue to people around him, like Jared Kushner, like Witkoff?
Well, Trump is the president, so he deals with many, many issues, and his attention span is not always very long. So it's certainly very much the people around him dealing with this. And I have heard from various aides of Netanyahu in recent weeks and months that while Trump and Netanyahu get along very well, the relationship between the various envoys that you mentioned, especially Witkoff and Kushner, is not that good. And they don't see things the same way, certainly not in Gaza.
And what can Trump give Netanyahu?
Well, Trump usually gives Netanyahu a lot of in the open, a lot of very complimentary treatment. He says things like, in their last meeting, he said that if it wasn't for Netanyahu, Israel may have been destroyed in October 7. And obviously that's rubbish, but that is the kind of stuff that Netanyahu likes to hear, and even more wants Israelis to be hearing. But that's, you know, that's the easy stuff that Trump can give him. Where it comes to actual trying to be a peacemaker, which is what Trump wants to be seen, then Trump goes towards quicker and compromises, which is what Netanyahu doesn't want to see. Netanyahu wants the talks to go on, and he doesn't want Iran or Hamas, from his perspective, to be let off lightly. And it seems that he thinks that Trump or Trump's team are doing that.
Anshul Pfeffer, the Israel correspondent for The Economist and biographer of Netanyahu, thank you very much indeed. And I should say that at 10 past 8, we will be hearing a very, very rare report from within Iran, speaking to our chief international correspondent, Liz Doucette. So do stay with us for that.
It is 17 minutes to 8. It is the International Day of Women and Girls in Science, an excellent day where we recognise the contribution of generations of women, some of whom just didn't get the recognition that they deserved at the time that they were doing their work. And the Royal Society is also launching an interactive app to mark it, to show where female scientists maybe made a discovery or where they furthered their research, the idea being to show that it's not just traditional locations, places like London or Oxford or Cambridge, where women have made a difference in science. Dr. Louisiane Ferlier is the Royal Society's historian. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
Tell me about some of the more little known places, perhaps, where women did wonderful science.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me on this day of women and girls in science. So as you said, we're launching a map which aims to celebrate the achievement of historical women. And this is part of our celebrations of the 80 years since the first women were elected to the Royal Society Fellowship. And for the last year, really, as part of the archives team, we've tried to uncover some of the stories that were less known. And seeing them on a map really shows you the spread of science done in the UK. So if I have one example, my favourite example would be Elsie Widdowson in the Lake District. So Elsie Widdowson was a pioneer nutritionist, and along with her long-term scientific partner, Robert McCance, they proposed the the rations for during the Second World War. But rather than just proposing something based on nutrition, they wanted to test it on themselves to make sure that it was healthy and that they could go on long hikes. So they went to the Lake District in January, in the middle of the war, in the middle of the winter, and went on very long walks to test the physical fitness. And so in the archives, we have accounts of the walks, and it's one of those little known, I think, stories that we have on the map.
That's the kind of science I can get on board with. Walking around the Lake District sounds like the sort of thing that all of us could enjoy. But also, I mean, there is an important reason behind all of this, which is that still, there, even though we have so many extraordinary female scientists, there is still space for many more. And it's about inspiring women and girls, really. That's what's at the heart of all of this, isn't it? To say, look at this person here, that person there, this woman who grew up near you and made this discovery. And it's, you can't be what you don't see.
Exactly. And so the idea with this map is that we're opening up the floor to the public, to your listeners, so that they can share their local stories. And really, the dream would be to have schools around the country ask girls and boys to look at the scientists around them, the female scientists who made a difference in their village, in a lab that is close to where they are, so that they can see that science is really around them. I think representation really matters. And we see a lot of girls doing really, really well in STEM subjects in school. But as you look at the career progressions, you see them drop off. And having really those stories of historical women who were at the top of the profession, I think helps and inspire the next generation.
It really does. Dr. Louise-Anne Ferlier, thank you for joining us.
It is 13 minutes to 8 and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning with me in the studio is the writer and broadcaster Ridian Brooke.
Good morning. In the rushed attempt to reckon with the Epstein files and work out what they mean, it's become hard to hear and easy to forget the women who were actually the victims of his crimes. If we are serious about understanding the forces that lie behind an elite network in which women and girls were trafficked for sex, we'd surely do well to start with the witness of the victims. Whenever these women have spoken, it is striking how eloquent they are, not just about what has happened to them, but also about the challenge of bringing the perpetrators of these crimes to justice. Many of them point to the heroism of Virginia Giuffre, who, against massive intimidation and, according to other survivors, the cost of her life, helped start the process that brought these crimes to light. In her memoir, Nobody's Girl, she wrote, "I hope for a world in which predators are punished, not protected, victims are treated with compassion, not shamed, and powerful people face the same consequences as anyone else." I read her book whilst researching a story for an opera about modern slavery. As part of my research, I interviewed a woman who had been sex trafficked alongside the policewoman who had rescued her from the trafficking gang. "Not once in 30 years of law enforcement," said the policewoman, "did I meet a pimp or sex trafficker who expressed remorse. They just saw women as product in a business transaction." Her words chimed with Giuffre's insight that we live in a culture that tells girls their primary worth is to appeal to men. Mere objects to discard once used, their humanity redacted. This thinking infects the Epstein files, where women and girls, some reportedly as young as 9, are offered as though they were meat on a menu. It's all done without shame and an entitled belief that for some, the rules don't apply. The psalmist describes it thus: "In their own eyes, they flatter themselves too much to detect their sin. Even on their beds, they plot evil, commit themselves to a sinful course, and do not reject what is wrong." We should want to live in a world where victims are treated with compassion, not as sympathy, but as a radical form of criticism that says this hurt is to be taken seriously, it's not normal, and we have to act. In his ministry, Jesus sided and stood with the abused and the used. His compassion for victims was an implicit critique of the systems, forces and ideologies that produce victims. At his execution, he entered into that hurt and came to embody it. On the cross, he redacts himself and becomes the victim God, a witness to and a reckoning for corrupt and controlling power.
That was Thought for the Day with Ridian Brooke, writer and broadcaster. The time now is 10 to 8.
Many, if not all, public services in this country face sharply rising cost pressures. You will have noticed that we make a habit of asking where the money will come from. Well, one rather sudden pressure, which few foresaw just a few years ago, is Special Educational Needs Provision, or SEND. Spending on these needs rose from $7.5 billion in 2016 to at least $12 billion in 2025, that is last year, and is forecast to spike very suddenly to $21 billion by 2029, so from $12 billion last year to $21 billion 3 years from now. More than 1.7 million children in England have special needs. The IFS, the Institute of Fiscal Studies, says this money has mostly been found by squeezing mainstream school budgets. The OBR has projected a £6 billion funding gap. That money needs to be found somewhere. Today, the government announces major reforms for SEND provision. All secondary schools will be expected to have a dedicated SEND base. And separately, £1 billion has been set aside to fix crumbling or overheated buildings and also to improve school facilities such as Wi-Fi. The school's standards minister is Georgia Gould, and she joins us now. Ms. Gould, good morning.
Good morning.
So what are you proposing to do differently?
So we're setting out today that every secondary school will be expected to have an inclusion base. And that is a bespoke space to support children with special educational needs and disabilities. And I've seen the difference that this makes, allowing children who'd been previously educated in corridors or who'd been out of school to be educated within their community, linked in to their friends, but with a space that they can go to, which is a smaller space, which is a less overwhelming space, to get the special support right. that they need.
If there's a strong case of doing it in secondary schools, why not do it in primary schools?
So we'll be rolling it out across primary schools as well, but we're saying, you know, clusters of primary schools can come together to provide these spaces. But it is really particularly critical that is that we have these in secondary schools, because what I hear from parents around the country and young people is it's you know, vast big secondary schools can be a big jump for children with special educational needs who thrived in primary school, but actually when they go into secondary they just can't cope with the scale of the space. So having some kind of inclusive spaces that children can kind of have nurturing support means that over time often they do go into full mainstream right. education.
There's going to be a lot of anxious parents around the country who are hearing this, who maybe have children who have these EHCPs, education healthcare plans, or are about to. So can I just ask you two very specific questions?
Sure.
What will change for children who currently have an EHCP?
So we'll be setting out our full plans shortly, but you know,
will anything change for them?
Our reforms are about putting more support in earlier for children. You talked about some of the rising costs at the beginning, and more money's gone into the system, but outcomes are getting worse, and children's needs are escalating because they don't have that early support. So you know, we'll be setting out the full package. But I've spoken to parents, you know, in every community, and I've heard their fears, but they all say they want to see early intervention. They want to see that support.
And
we're really clear that there will always be a legal basis to that additional support.
So they might have to wait for your white paper on it. What about parents who are going through the very stressful process of diagnosis now, applying for an EHCP? What do they need to know about what's changing for them?
I think that, you know, one of the issues I hear all the time is, you know, talking to somebody recently where they're, you know, they know their child needs support, they ask for support, but they have to wait often years for a diagnosis, for legal processes, rather than just getting that support at the time that they need it. And you shouldn't need a diagnosis to have support wrapped around you. And this is, you know, there's large-scale reform we're putting in place to support that early intervention. We've invested £200 million in teacher training, so every teacher is a teacher for special educational needs and disabilities, and then £3.7 billion into capital investment to make our schools more inclusive.
But on that reform, it's not entirely clear what, for people who've currently got an EHCP, what changes. You say they'll have to wait for you to set out your proposals.
Yeah.
For people who might be going through the process now, they're going to have to wait. You know, on the 11th of June last year, your colleague said it would all be set out in a white paper in the autumn. Mm. On October the 22nd, Bridget Phillipson said it would be early in the new year. On January the 23rd, so a couple of weeks ago, you said it was still in development. Why is this white paper taking so long?
So we've taken the time to talk to young people and families, teachers around the country, and I've had thousands of conversations, and we need to make sure that this system improves, because young people have been badly failed.
Great. So when are they going to get it? When are they going to get it?
We're going to be bringing it out. We've said, you know, in the early part of the year, we'll be coming out soon. But today we are making a big step forward in putting in place inclusion places in every secondary school. This is, you know, backed by £3.7 billion of investment. We're not waiting to take action, but, you know, we are rightly listening to those who are most impacted to get this right.
A final thought on that. Where's that money coming from?
£3.7 billion. That's coming as part of our package that we got as a department.
Yeah, but which
budget
is it coming out of?
So it's coming out of our capital budget.
Out of education, not out of the Treasury?
Yeah, so our education budget is part of our settlement that we got.
At the budget. So it's not coming out of the Treasury. In other words, that 3.7 is money that's not going to other parts of education.
Well, it's money that we got as part of our kind of capital portfolio, and okay. we're choosing to invest that into accessibility.
Let's talk about the state of your party. So Matthew Doyle, who used to be Keir Starmer's comms chief, was cleared by an internal Number 10 inquiry in December. But there's been some outstanding reporting on his story by Gabriel Pogrind at the Sunday Times, and that proved that that inquiry was a sham. It got things very wrong. Why is the political operation in Number 10 so consistently ineffective?
I think that we are absolutely clear that this hasn't been good enough. The Prime Minister said on Monday night to Labour MPs that we needed to have the highest standards in public life and that he was determined to change things. And that's why he's taken the decision to remove the whip from Matthew Doyle. And he said that we need to turn this on its head.
Why is it so bad? What's your analysis? You know him very well. Why is it so bad? I mean, put aside all the Mandelson stuff, right? Here's yet another example. If a journalist comes forward and says, you've got this real problem, this real issue, so no, we'll have an inquiry, we'll look into it, you do an inquiry, it's complete waste of time. And here you are 6 weeks on, not answering questions about education as you'd like to be, but about Matthew Doyle. Why was that inquiry such a sham? Why is the political operation in Number 10 so consistently so poor?
Look, I do know Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, very well. I was the council leader where he was the local MP. And what I can say about Keir Starmer is he is a man of huge integrity.
I'm asking about the Number 10 operations.
Well, I think you asked what I can reflect on having known him. And I think the important thing to say is his purpose is about changing things in the country. That's what he gets up every day to think about. And I think he is, you know, being deeply focused on the huge challenges we face. We're talking about one today, crumbling school buildings under the last government, on supporting addressing violence against women and girls, the big international affairs. And I think he has said himself he needs to be more focused on ensuring that there are better processes in place. No one has been tougher on the Prime Minister than he has been on himself, okay. And he's determined to change things.
Georgia Gould, School Standards Minister, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Skis cutting through snow at breathtaking speed. Snowboards spinning in ways never seen before. Skeleton sleds pushing the limits. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics. Watch live on BBC iPlayer.
Simon King's got the weather. Hi, Simon.
Abel, thanks so much indeed. Yes, good morning. Across England and Wales, it's a cloudy, misty and murky start today. We've got some areas of rain out there across northern England, the Midlands, into eastern and southeastern areas at the moment. Elsewhere, patchy rain. Now, there may be some brighter skies developing for maybe an hour or two in parts of southwest England, the south Midlands and the southeast this afternoon. And where you get a bit of sunshine, feel quite mild, really. Temperatures about 12 or 13 degrees. But as I said, it's only going to be for a short time. Further heavy rain spreads in from the southwest later into the evening. And elsewhere, temperatures today of 7 to 11 degrees. Scotland, Northern Ireland, again, cloudy. Some patches of mist and fog, lots of rain around, particularly eastern and southwestern Scotland, and temperatures 3 to 7 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. This is Today on BBC Radio 4.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of February. The headlines. One of the worst mass shootings in Canada's history has left 9 people dead and 25 wounded at a school and nearby home in British Columbia. According to an FBI document, a former police chief in Florida said Donald Trump rang him 20 years ago and told him everyone knew about Jeffrey Epstein's behaviour. A new report says there was a spike in anti-Semitic incidents after the deadly attack on a synagogue in Manchester involving taunting and celebration.
In the next 10 minutes of the programme, we'll be hearing from inside Iran, from those who live and work there.
I think we're going through a really, really hard time in our country, and just nothing is stable here right now. And I guess people are having a really tough time.
And a lawyer at a landmark trial in California has accused the tech giants Meta and Google of engineering addiction in children's brains. We'll hear from the former Facebook worker Frances Haugen on what this trial tells us about the relationship between technology companies and democracy.
I always like to joke, other places can pass laws,
we sue. And sometimes there are these large societal problems like tobacco, like opiates, where we can't get Congress to come to a good path forward. And the way it gets resolved is by these large class action lawsuits.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
At least 9 people have been shot dead and 25 injured at a school and nearby home in British Columbia in what Canadian officials have described as one of the worst mass shootings in the country's history. Police say the suspected shooter was found dead at the school. According to Canadian media, an alert sent during the attack described the suspect as a female in a dress with brown hair. The Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has called the killings horrific and cancelled a planned trip to the Munich Security Conference. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police said it received a report of an active shooter at a school in the small town of Tumbler Ridge, which lies in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, shortly after lunchtime. During a search of the school, 6 people were found dead, while a 7th died on the way to hospital. The authorities say another person, believed to be the attacker, was also discovered dead inside the building, with what appeared to be a self-inflicted injury. Officials say the shooting at the school and at a nearby home where 2 bodies were found are believed to be linked. The police say they don't yet know the attacker's connection to the school. A community lockdown was cancelled after the authorities said they didn't believe there were any outstanding suspects or ongoing threats to the public.
Chris Norbury's wife is a teacher at the school where students say they barricaded classroom doors for 2 hours until police escorted them away. He told this programme that the community is in shock.
It's an incredibly safe community. You know, people don't lock your doors. Our cars aren't locked. We don't have to worry about crime here. So this is such an unbelievable tragedy that has happened here because it's not something that you would ever think would happen.
A document released in the latest batch of files about Jeffrey Epstein suggests Donald Trump told a police chief in Florida 20 years ago that everyone knew about the paedophile's behaviour. The claim was made in an FBI interview in 2019 with the now former head of Palm Beach Police, who said Mr. Trump called him after an investigation was opened into Epstein. A Justice Department official said they were not aware of any evidence to support that claim. Adam Gocher reports.
The document is a written record of a 2019 FBI interview with the former police chief in Palm Beach, who claims that Mr. Trump called him after the department launched an investigation into Epstein and said, "Thank goodness you're stopping him. Everyone has known he's been doing this." The officer's name is redacted, but the document identifies him as Michael Reiter, who, according to the Miami Herald newspaper, has confirmed that the conversation with Mr. Trump happened in July 2006, when he was the chief of police. The FBI's summary of the interview says Mr. Trump told him he'd thrown Epstein out of his Mar-a-Lago club and that people in New York knew he was disgusting. Asked by reporters in 2019, when Epstein was arrested by federal agents for sex trafficking, if he had any suspicions about the disgraced financier, Mr. Trump said, "No, I had no idea," adding, "I haven't spoken to him in many, many years."
The Prince of Wales is on the final day of his official visit to Saudi Arabia, a trip that has at times been eclipsed by questions about his uncle, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's relationship with Epstein. Prince William will spend the day in the desert region of Alula in the northwest of the country. Our senior royal correspondent Daniela Relf is there.
It is the final day of a challenging visit to Saudi Arabia for the Prince of Wales. What was expected to be a diplomatically sensitive trip has at times been overshadowed by events at home. For Prince William's team, it's been hard to stay focused on their work here when stories and allegations continue to emerge about the relationship between Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor and Jeffrey Epstein. Today the Prince is in Alula, a 7,000-year-old archaeological area. His engagements will look at wildlife, the environment and culture, themes Kensington Palace would like to stick to. But the Epstein story remains a distraction.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to push the US to take a tougher stance in nuclear talks with Iran when he meets President Trump at the White House later. The negotiations restarted last week against the backdrop of a large American military build-up in the region. Iran is marking the 10th and final day of events commemorating the anniversary of the Islamic Republic after last month's violent crackdown on anti-government protests in which thousands of people were killed. Our correspondent Lise Doucette is reporting from the Iranian capital, Tehran, on condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. These restrictions apply to all international media organisations operating in Iran.
Across Tehran and other cities, the streets are decked with flags and bunting. Newly painted murals adorn some squares. It's all part of annual celebrations to mark the anniversary of Iran's Islamic Revolution. But this year, the 47th, comes at a time when its clerical rulers confront their greatest challenge. Last night, when we heard Iranians chanting Allahu Akbar, God is greatest, from windows and rooftops, we also heard shouts of death to the dictator, death to Khamenei, a reference to Iran's supreme leader. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has called on Iranians to take to the streets today to show their loyalty to the Islamic Republic and to drive its enemies to despair.
A report says 3,700 anti-Semitic incidents were recorded in Britain last year, the second highest annual total after 2023, the year of the October the 7th attack on Israel by Hamas. The figures were compiled by the Community Security Trust, which monitors incidents of anti-Jewish hate. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, described the numbers as shocking and said the government was providing record funding for security at synagogues, Jewish schools and community centres. Here's our religion editor, Ali Makbul.
Last year was the second worst in terms of anti-Semitic incidents in Britain since the Community Security Trust, or CST, started recording such data in 1984. 2025 had the first deadly anti-Semitic attack during those 42 years when, on Yom Kippur in October, two people were killed and three seriously injured at the Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. But what the CST's reporting also shows is that there was a spike in anti-Semitic incidents recorded in the immediate aftermath of that synagogue attack, in some cases involving what the organisation calls face-to-face taunting and celebration of the attack to Jewish people.
US officials investigating the disappearance of a television news presenter's mother in Arizona say they have detained a person of interest. The announcement follows the release of video footage showing a masked man at Nancy Guthrie's front door in Tucson. From there, David Willis reports.
A statement from the local sheriff's department says its officers detained an individual during a traffic stop, and that person is being questioned in connection with Nancy Guthrie's disappearance. A search of premises associated with the individual is also taking place. 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie went missing from her home here 10 days ago, and the news that a suspect had been detained came only hours after the FBI released security camera pictures of a masked individual tampering with the camera at her front door around the time of her disappearance. A ransom note emailed to media outlets demanded $6 million in Bitcoin in return for Mrs. Guthrie's release.
Britain is to double the number of troops deployed in Norway to 2,000 over the next 3 years as part of a NATO mission to defend the Arctic. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, says Russia poses the biggest threat to the security of the region since the Cold War. Harrods has said that more than 180 survivors of abuse by the store's former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, are currently engaged in its compensation scheme. The luxury retailer said it had already made payments to more than 50 victims. Hundreds of women have accused Fayed of rape and sexual assault. Ellie Price reports.
Harrods has set aside more than £60 million to compensate any victims of historical abuse. The department store has previously said victims could receive up to £385,000 in compensation, plus treatment costs, if they agree to be assessed by a consultant psychiatrist. Those who choose not to be medically assessed by a psychiatrist will receive lower payments. The Harrods redress scheme opened to survivors last March and will close to new applicants at the end of March this year, though it said submissions made by the deadline will still be processed after that date.
The state of Sao Paulo in Brazil is allowing animals to be buried in family graves in recognition of the emotional bond between animals and humans. The new law was inspired by a local dog, Bob Cavero, who lived for 10 years in a municipal cemetery after his owner was buried there. When the dog died, he was placed with the remains of his owner.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 10 minutes past eight. As an American aircraft carrier strike group waits, poised in the Gulf, primed for a potential US attack on Iran, the country is celebrating the flags and the fireworks that mark the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution hide this year a deep pain after thousands of protesters were killed by regime forces as they protested on the streets for a better life and for the end of the repressive leadership that has caused Iran such damage in recent times. Right now, the US and Iran are talking, but it's a volatile relationship with no guarantee that discussions will hold off a US attack should President Trump decide to launch one. Well, for the first time since those brutal and devastating protests, the BBC is able to report from inside Iran. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in the capital, Tehran, working on the condition that none of her material is used on the BBC's Persian service. It's a restriction that applies to all international media organisations operating in Iran. Now, the Iranian government is hoping that the anniversary event in Tehran will see its supporters flooding the streets. Last night, more than 2,000 amnesties were announced, but none of the tens of thousands of people arrested and convicted during that violent crackdown on protesters were included in it. Well, let's speak live to Lise Doucette. Lise, good morning. What have you been seeing there?
Good morning, Anna. We are now in the central part of Tehran. We're very close to an iconic landmark, Inqilab, or Revolution Square. And for hours this morning, Iranians have been moving from here by foot along a nearly 3-mile walk to another main square where leaders of the Islamic Republic have gathered. It's Azadeh, or Freedom Square. This is an annual rally. It marks the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. But as you've been pointing out, this year is very different. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has called on Iranians to come out in large numbers today to show their loyalty to the Islamic Republic and, in his words, to send a message to its enemies. It's meant to be a show of strength. After Iranians had taken to the streets last month in an unprecedented wave of anger and defiance. From what we can see from here where we are, from the videos from other cities, people are in the streets today. But there are many Iranians who are not focused on this anniversary. They're focused on another date, the upcoming 40th day since January 8th, a day of mourning, the day when those intense protests were met by lethal force in an almost complete internet blackout. So yesterday, on our first day back in the city, we went to Revolution Square to be able to hear for ourselves what is on people's minds. The traffic is brisk, as you can hear. Many people going about their day. We're in Revolution Square in Tehran, an iconic square. And the place is surrounded by brightly colored murals, which have just been put up. The bunting is out and the flags as Iran marks 47 years of their revolution. But this is a truly momentous time in Iran, just weeks after the unprecedented protests were met by an unprecedented crackdown. Iranians are facing crises on every front. And so we're going to speak to some of them to see what's on their mind.
Khatarnak.
It's dangerous.
Khatarnak.
Like she said, dangerous.
Yeah. You said dangerous? Okay, we understand, we understand. It's a very sensitive time. We might hear it more than usual. Hello, what's your first name?
I'm Dori.
Dori, and how old are you?
I'm 20.
What's the main worry on your mind these days?
Oh, well, in the circumstances right now, I mean, I don't see the situation very well because I think we're going through a really, really hard time in our country and just nothing is stable here right now. And I guess people are having a really tough time during their lives and everything costs so high. And I just think that there's nothing stable right now in the country.
And can I ask what you do know about this last month?
Well, the last month was really terrible. We went through the blackout of internet and we could just know nothing about our country and how what happened to people. And after the connections, we saw a lot of horrible videos and photos from people who were under attacks. And the pictures were really so disappointing and they just made you cry out. And everything was so terrible, actually.
What's your message to your leaders then after this terrible moment?
Leaders of our country? Okay, I cannot say that on the microphone, but...
Do you think it will get better?
With the way that they're going through, I think that... I just hope that everything doesn't just get worse. So
because I think nothing's going to get better, actually.
It's such an important time in Iran. What's on your mind now? She's crying. Oh, I'm so sorry. Mehbakhshin, she started to cry. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. Did you lose somebody?
It has been a month now since I haven't eaten or slept properly. Look at me. I'm young, only 32 years old. Why should I be ravished and look depressed? What is my sin? What crime did I commit? Why? I swear to God, they kept calling people, the protesters, rioters. But people were not armed.
Salam. Your name is...
Amir.
Amir.
What can I say? It is a hard time. The people and we are all upset about the situation. There were lots of people that now they aren't here with us and we are upset about that.
Because they were killed?
Yes. And I have also other concerns too. They say there are possibilities that America is going to attack us. I think people are worried about that.
Do you hope that the negotiations between the United States and Iran succeed?
Yes, I do hope that it succeeds.
And do you think that would help make your life better?
Yes, I think that will make our lives, our economic situation better.
But do you worry that there is a very real risk of another war?
Yes, I think it can be a very dangerous war. It would be a terrible situation.
It's 47 years of the Islamic Revolution. What is your message to your leaders then at this time?
I think we should hear our people's voices. We shouldn't do what we want. It's important. Leaders and people that are responsible for this country, they must hear what people say and do what people want, not the things they want to do.
Monty, okay. Do you want to say something? Your friend?
I'm so sad about the Iran. I think that Jamhuri Islami like a cancer in our country, and I can't speak more. I'm so,
so sorry.
Sad.
Did you lose friends in the protests?
No, I didn't lose any of my friends, but I see a lot of people. My best friend has lost his friends, and I'm not okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Do you still have hope? For your future?
For my future, I think so. But about Iran, I don't know. I don't have any idea about Iran's future of Iran. And don't know what will happen to us.
What would you like to happen?
I just want to access the basic...
Basic normal life.
Basic
freedoms or
all basic freedoms, basic economy, you know, all of
basic
us.
Basic needs met.
So bad. But
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
thank you for sharing your thoughts. Just listen to the voices. This is a deeply worrying time, a painful time. And for the leadership of Iran, a defining moment. Never has the leadership faced a challenge on this scale. This kind of unrest and dissatisfaction and anger at home and growing threats from abroad. This Islamic Revolution anniversary is unlike any this country has known.
Least you sat there reporting from Tehran. You could hear the self-control, the self-restraint of some of the people that she was speaking to there, but those flashes of emotion as well, where you really see and hear what's been happening over the last few weeks. Well, let's speak to Mehran Kamrava, who's Professor of Government at Georgetown University in Qatar and Director of the Iranian Studies Unit at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do the Iranian leadership believe that the US will launch a military strike on them?
Yes, they do. In fact, it was precisely at a time like this, back in June of 2025, in between negotiations, when the United States attacked Iran. And there's been heightened awareness and there's been a heightened sense of worry in Iran among the Iranian leadership and sense of preparedness that the United States is going to launch another attack precisely in between the negotiations.
Are there any concessions that Iran is prepared to make to try and stop that from happening on ballistic missiles, on proxy groups, on the nuclear program particularly?
Iran's behavior in the negotiations, as far as we know, has been quite counterintuitive. The assumption is that the Iranian leadership has been weakened due to unprecedented demonstrations in across Iran and because of the attacks, the military attacks. But in the negotiations, Iran has taken a tough line. And in fact, the foreign minister has come out and said that any concession would be misconstrued by the United States and others as a sign of weakness, and therefore Iran is unwilling to make any concessions, at least in public. But I think in private, certainly Araghchi has said that there's been no enrichment due to the extensive damage that Iran's nuclear facilities suffered in the last round of attacks.
Is the regime holding firm in private? Because obviously, as we've discussed many times, a simple military attack on one part or another of it will not be enough to try and it will not be enough to collapse the regime altogether. Are there any weaknesses, any sign that the defections might be likely, any sign that things might be about to change?
We don't see any signs from the outside, and certainly it appears that all the key institutions of the state, particularly the Revolutionary Guards, are cohesive and remain quite powerful. And we just heard in Liz's powerful report from Tehran, we got insight into the collective wound that Iranians are suffering from right now. We saw how there's this collective sense of resignation and depression across the country, collectively, by almost every single Iranian. So it appears that the pressures from within have been effectively dealt with by a very repressive political system, and that the political system remains firmly in control, at least for the time being. And therefore, it doesn't appear that the Islamic Republic is in any mood to make any sort of a concession, either domestically or internationally.
Mehran Kamrava, thank you for joining us.
Well, the time now is 24 minutes past 8. Across the world today, there seems to be something of a recalibration going on in the relationship between technology and democracy. In Australia, France and Spain, governments have stepped in to, as they see it, protect children. There seems to be growing pressure on the government here to do the same. And in America, a series of huge trials could shift US public opinion and law. One begins in California today, and it's a huge collective action claiming that social media apps, broadly defined, are addictive. Again, broadly defined. It's the first time that social media companies will face trial by jury. Moreover, Mark Zuckerberg is among those due to give testimony. Frances Haugen is a former Facebook engineer turned whistleblower. In 2021, she disclosed thousands of documents to the Securities and Exchange Commission and wrote a book called The Power of One. Meta, the owner of Facebook, contends that she hasn't worked at the company for many years, in fact, since 2021. They say that they've got no incentive to turn children into addicts and that they've rolled out many safety features for kids. And they add that social media apps often suck up the blame for mental health issues whose real cause lies elsewhere in individual lives or social ecologies. But when I spoke to Frances Haugen, I put to her that the trial in California beginning today is going to include some pretty blockbuster testimony of a kind that we haven't seen for some time and which will inevitably raise the profile of these issues both in America and beyond.
Unquestionably, ever since Australia was the first mover in terms of banning social media for under 16s back in December, and Spain following on just maybe a week ago with a similar under 16 ban, Now the United States is coming to the table. And I always like to joke, you know, other places can pass laws, we sue. And sometimes there are these large societal problems like tobacco, like opiates, where we can't get Congress to come to a good path forward. And the way it gets resolved is by these large class action lawsuits.
What did you see when you worked in the sector about the ways in which these companies particularly target young people, and also the ways in which, as you contend in your book about your time there, when faced with a choice as to whether to choose child safety or to choose profit, they tend to choose the latter?
In the case of social media, a handful of platforms, particularly I think Meta is probably the most egregious of them, have really benefited from the fact that every one of us has a very different experience of social media. Like your feed, my feed, the feed of a child are all very, very different. Even amongst kids, they're not all the same. And because it has been so hard to answer this question, what is social media? What is the experience? They've been able to underinvest in safety. When I was there the last year I spent at Meta, I spent it within the threat intelligence org. And among the different teams that I supported, one of them was the child safety team. And what shocked me about not just child safety, but about counter-espionage, about information operations scams, was that even a tiny bit more resources, like one software engineer, like we're not talking about a team of 100 people, even one software engineer would have doubled the productivity of those teams. And so the question becomes, why would you not do such a minimal investment if it has such large returns? And it's because if people don't know what your negligence is doing, if they can't prove it, you know, it's a business expense. You don't have to take responsibility. No one is holding the mirror to your face.
So since you wrote your book, since you left Meta, you've had to contend with a huge amount of pushback and indeed, I suppose, legal threat from these companies. And I want to put to you what they say, because they have a very consistent position, which they say volubly and indeed they say to us. And the first is these companies, they say they don't gain anything from exploiting children. The last thing they want is the reputational or moral damage of seeing children become addicts and people being able to prove these products cause them harm. That's the first thing. Then they say they've spent billions and billions and billions actually specifically trying to keep children safe, whether that's through hiring software engineers or moderators or making sure that if children were in trouble, there were mechanisms by which they could express a plea for help. And the other thing they say is, if you, Francis, and other people are so keen to talk about the damage these platforms do, just wait until these children go to other platforms on the internet, which are much more dangerous.
So I think there's a couple different things there. One is I would love to see their actual quote where they say they've spent billions. That's, you know, I'm guessing 90s, at least for Americans, not 60s. I was a little confused on, I think there's a difference between British and American. When I was at Meta, for example, I saw consistently, you know, they'd put side by side lists of what safety systems existed on Facebook.com and what safety systems existed on Instagram. And because Instagram was so much less funded than Facebook, maybe a third as many safety systems existed on Instagram. Why would you have fewer safety systems for the platform that is primarily occupied by children, other than when children complain, we don't listen as much as when 45-year-olds do? But I think the secondary thing is, if you look at the timing of when they roll out these safety features, you know, probably the two largest single launches where they did a big step change in improving the platforms, one happened during the week before the UK age-appropriate design code went into effect. So that's the landmark law where the UK said, hey, you have to actually think at least a little bit about how your products are going to impact kids. And they rolled out, you know, maybe 10 safety features at that time. And the other was right before Australia announced they were going to work towards putting in an under 16 ban. My question for you is, if some of these features are really simple, it's things like, should you by default make children's accounts, like under 16's accounts, which really means like 8-year-olds, because they weren't stopping 8-year-olds from joining. Should those accounts be the most public? Or should you start them out with more private accounts and let them open up their accounts as they go along? That's a feature people have been asking for 10 years, but they didn't put it in place until Australia threatened to ban social media.
But is it your contention that there is now persuasive evidence that these products, albeit I'm mindful of your point that we have different experiences as individuals on social media, but is your contention that there is now definitive evidence that these products are addictive?
So the word addictive is always, you have to be a little careful about it, because addiction applies like a physiological dependency. I think people often describe it as, is it a thing that causes compulsive behavior? Is it a thing where when you ask people, do you want to use this product? They say no. You say, can you control your usage? They say no. We often think about those things analogously to addiction. You know, the documents I brought out, which was a very small number of documents when it came to kids, it showed that kids were saying, I can't sleep at night because I can't put this down. I have trouble focusing in school because of the notifications that come in. What we've seen as a result of these court cases is that Facebook didn't just know that kids were saying this. They were running experiments to try to make these problems less bad. Really intuitive ones, like maybe we shouldn't send you a notification at 11 o'clock at night. Maybe we shouldn't send you a notification at 1 in the afternoon on a school day. And kids were saying, I can focus on school better. I can sleep better. But they didn't launch them because they also use the product 1% less. These are the kinds of conversations that are really urgent right now.
Well, that was Frances Haugen speaking, author of The Power of One, a Facebook whistleblower. We asked Meta, the parent company, about some of the points that she raises and about the trial. They told us, and I quote, we strongly disagree with these allegations. For over a decade, we've listened to parents, worked with experts and law enforcement, and conducted in-depth research to understand the issues that matter most. We use these insights to make meaningful changes, like introducing teen accounts with built-in protections and providing parents with the tools to manage their teens' experiences. They also said they'd made choices to help parents and teenagers manage their time on their sites. Time now is 28 minutes to 9.
And it's time for The Sport with Jonathan Ledyard.
Hi there. How good is this football season shaping up for Arsenal fans? Their club is top of the Premier League by 6 points, and their North London rivals Tottenham slipped to fifth bottom last night after another defeat, 2-1 at home to Newcastle. But Manchester City could trim Arsenal's advantage if they beat Fulham tonight, coverage on 5 Live. And a reminder that Harry Brooks' England cricket team play the West Indies in their second match at the T20 World Cup, Test Match Special from 1:15, 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. Meanwhile, with Team GB still waiting to celebrate their first medal of the 2026 Winter Olympics, is tonight the night when figure skaters Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson make their biggest moves yet on the greatest stage of all? Their dynamic routine to a Spice Girls medley in the rhythm dance on Monday night saw them qualify fourth for this evening's decisive free dance. Can they become Britain's first Olympic figure skating medalist since Torvald and Dean's comeback in 1994? Let's talk to Britain's gold medalist from the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, Robin Cousins. A very good morning.
Good morning.
Here's a first question. Is there a skill in choosing the music to dance to which engages the crowd at the same time as enabling you, the skater, to showcase how good you are?
Absolutely, which is the whole point of the music in the first place. It was a very big deal for me, and it's certainly a big deal for Lila and Lewis. And it's really what's got their attention to an audience alongside judges and a public from the first year that they were together. They're very clear that they have an agenda in what they want to show and how they want to feel when they're skating. The difficulty then is choreographically to deliver what's required for that particular season element-wise, the lifts, the spins, the step sequences, etc. But then it's also, how do I make it so that it is honest? It has that great appeal. And even though the judges are, you know, they're all impartial, they're supposed to sit there, you cannot help, when the audience has got behind an athlete, to feel that vibe and to go along with it. And feel the vibe is what the Irish say, you know, skate your vibe, enjoy it. That's what Lila and Lewis do. The Spice Girls played into that perfectly. They are less than a point behind the medalists right now. And the good news, I think good news, they skate first of those final four. So they can have nothing to lose, go out and enjoy skating to the Proclaimers tonight.
I was going to say, so what difference is that going to make then? How exciting is that, the energy and the different dynamic?
It is a different dynamic, but it's still a great energy dynamic. And again, the audience will recognise it. There'll be some tunes and style in there. And it's a very specific flavour. It's very Scottish and it's great and makes Lewis feel phenomenal. He feels phenomenal. He'll work hard with his partner. They'll work together. And we will be all fingers, everything crossed, that they can actually just enjoy that moment. And I hope they skate as well as they did the other night, because I thought they were sensational. And they proved themselves in the team event as well, placing third in that sequence. So, yeah, it's all to play for. and all to go for, and I just hope they do.
One thought, simply, how easy to stay at that level knowing what's at stake? There's an Olympic medal at stake.
I get asked this a lot, and it was a piece of advice I was given, is that you simply have to step on the ice and do your day job. Don't try and be anything special. The event is special. What you are doing is what you do every day. And you're just doing it on a huge stage. There's 11,000 people in that arena. You don't really think about the people that are watching at home, or you shouldn't. So that's the thing. You just got to try and keep a level head and keep it focused and enjoy that moment, because the Olympics are unique.
So says an Olympic champion, Robin Cousins. Thank you so much. Robin will be part of the commentary with Kat Downs, BBC. It starts at 6:30. Good luck also, as well as Lila Fear and Lewis Gibson, to Britain's Phoebe Becker and James Hernandez also competing. If you want to get in the mood, the Proclaimers, I'm Gonna Be, 500 Miles is the music they'll be playing and dancing to. Get with it. Come on, Amol, get with it.
Get with it. Jonathan, thank you. Now here's Matthew Syed with a word about his programme coming up at 9.
If I mention the ticking biological clock, you probably think that I'm talking about a woman running out of time before she can have a baby. But today, in Sideways, I follow the extraordinary journey of a man who, as he approached 50, realised his time was nearly up to fulfil a deeply buried desire to become a dad above all else. I want to find out why his story challenges many of our assumptions about broodiness. Join me, Matthew Syed, for Sideways, this morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Always look forward to that with Matthew Syed. A quick look at the weather. A cloudy and damp start today with patchy rain, but it will clear across the afternoon, leaving isolated showers, but staying breezy and mild.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amol Rajan in London and Anna Foster in Salford. Let's get a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
At least 9 people have been shot dead and 25 injured at a school and nearby home in Canada. The suspected attacker was found dead at the secondary school in British Columbia. Canadian officials have described the attack as one of the worst mass shootings in the country's history. An FBI document released in the latest batch of files about Jeffrey Epstein says Donald Trump told a police chief in Florida 20 years ago that everyone knew about the paedophile's behaviour. A Justice Department official said they were not aware of any corroborating evidence to suggest that the conversation took place. The president has previously said he had no idea about Epstein's crimes. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to push the US to take a tougher stance in nuclear talks with Iran when he meets President Trump at the White House later. The negotiations restarted last week against the backdrop of a large American military build-up in the region. Reports of anti-Semitism incidents in Britain spiked after the deadly Manchester synagogue attack last year. The Community Security Trust, which provides security and monitors anti-Semitism, said 40 incidents were recorded on the day of the attack and 40 the day after, the highest daily totals of 2025.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. The time is 21 minutes to 9. It's the final day of Prince William's trip to Saudi Arabia. It's been a tough trip for him. On the one hand, trying to drum up business for Britain and spotlight noble environmental work. On the other hand, the constant drip of revelations over not just his Uncle Andrew's association with Jeffrey Epstein, but the fact that his ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, took her 2 daughters, Eugenie and Beatrice, to see Mr. Epstein 5 days after his release from prison following his conviction for soliciting sex with a minor. Beyond that, there is the diplomatic difficulty of the Saudi administration's knowledge of the murder and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His widow, Hanan, said the following to us earlier today.
I'm still seeking the help of His Royal Highness Prince William before he departs from Saudi Arabia to have a talk, to have a word with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And I believe strongly he can, about human rights, especially about the case of Jamal, especially about the second victim still alive, which is me. But it's appear to me everybody's scared, so scared to speak to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, even the people around him. Everybody is very intimidated. And I really hope Prince William can have the gut, and I believe strongly he can. He's a very good future king of United Kingdom. He can do a lot by just speak, even in a friendly way, to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to try to do something for this case, to compensate me, to apologize, and show sincere to the world they do regret about this horrible crime.
Well, that was Hanan Khashoggi. Let's turn now to Sir Geoffrey Nice, the leading human rights lawyer who led the prosecution of former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. Sir Geoffrey, good morning.
Morning.
We've heard many voices on this programme in recent days saying you've got to be pragmatic, you've got to do business with people who might be mad. Is there also a rather different principle case that, in fact, you should have nothing to do with people who chop up journalists?
The reaction to that general proposition will depend a bit on where you sit in a country like ours. If you're on the breadline or you're in poverty and you just want some advance in the economy in order that you can earn a living and support your family, you will react in one way. If you're not in that position, such as people like you and me, we might react in another. I would, of course, personally take the view of full support of Mrs. Khashoggi, but I'd also go further than that and say that such a trip as is being engaged in by the Prince of Wales could be extremely useful for further human rights abuses committed in Saudi Arabia or the practice of capital punishment committed in Saudi Arabia. So if you look at the Prince of Wales' second objective, or maybe his second objective, which will have to do with football in the FIFA 2034 World Cup, can you imagine what would be the consequence, not just for the Khashoggis, but for people generally and for the world generally, if all those countries that did not engage in capital punishment, it's about 2-1, or that have suspended it, said we won't take part in 2034 unless you stop executing people by beheading them at the rate of roughly one per day, which has been the practice for the last 2 years. So you've got a conflict between what can be achieved by soft power, and football is in a sense soft power, and what is required by people who are absolutely dependent on economic advance.
On the broad issue, it's often said these days, or often written, that Saudi Arabia is in a process of transition towards a more liberal state, that its human rights record has improved. Is that true?
It may be that it's improved, but it hasn't improved anything like fast enough. And I think some of the alleged improvement is rather varnished by the Saudi Arabian authorities and those sympathetic to it. And we have to bear in mind that we, in a country like ours, allow geographical distance to dilute the criticisms that we would otherwise make of a country like Saudi Arabia. If you consider the practices that go on in Saudi Arabia and translate them or transfer them in your imagination to one of our immediate neighbors, you know, Ireland or Spain or France or something like that, and imagine those events happening in such a country so close to us, and then think of one of our leaders or one of our royal family going to such a country, you might think that would be very difficult for them to engage in. And we want them to be fierce or strong in their assertions of desire for change in human rights or perhaps elimination of capital punishment. But these things are all done behind closed doors, and we are told in summary the matter was raised. But we never know with what ferocity or with what...
And with what actual sincerity as well. You've been asked to go to Saudi yourself in support of an orchestra that does human rights work in the Balkans. How are you feeling about that proposal?
I think it's very unlikely that I would go for a whole range of reasons, and I don't think it would be necessary for me to go. But the whole decision is not for me because I'm not on the main board of that organisation, and it will have the difficult decisions itself to make. I think in accepting soft power, cultural soft power from Saudi Arabia, that's a really difficult decision for organisations that are confronted with that, because they have to balance the benefit for their organisation in another part of the world against the apparent enhancement of Saudi Arabia's image that their accepting of help will give. Mm. So it's very much parallel to what governments do on a hugely enlarged basis. And I think it's an enormously difficult decision. That we have to accept that the government has, because of the way we are as a country economically, to put economic advance ahead of everything else.
Yes, yes, indeed. So Geoffrey Nice, leading human rights lawyer, forgive me, we've got to end it there. Thank you very much indeed for your time this morning.
It's 8:45. The Community Security Trust, which provides security for the Jewish community in the UK, has published its annual anti-Semitism report, showing that 2025 had the second highest total of recorded incidents. It also had the first fatal anti-Semitic attack in this country when worshippers at a synagogue in Manchester were targeted on Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. Now in Australia, you'll remember shortly after two gunmen murdered Jewish people celebrating Hanukkah, Nick spoke to people gathering in a North London park to mark that Jewish holiday. And this man described conversations that his family had been having.
Most Jewish families of this day and age having those conversations, is it safe in the UK anymore? And given the kind of political landscape and everything that's going on, it's a valid question. You know, my grandmother says to me, how much longer is it going to be safe for us here? Think about moving to Israel.
Do you mind me asking where your grandmother's from?
Originally? Yeah, she's from here originally.
She's a British Jew,
grew up.
So how extraordinary is it in this day and age that you, born British, two British parents, two British grandparents, have to have a conversation about whether you can live here?
I know, it is an extraordinary circumstance, and I think it's hard to explain to anyone who's not Jewish about that, because ultimately, wherever we go historically for thousands of years, we're always a guest from where we are until there's an uprising, a persecution, we have to move on. And to her, looking at the situation today, she thinks we're getting to that point of inflection where it might be time for us. I'm not convinced, but again, people in the community are having those conversations.
Well, let's speak to Dave Rich, who's Director of Policy for the Community Security Trust. Good morning. Dave Rich, good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning. I can hear you fine.
Morning, Dave. That's good to hear. I want to talk about that attack we mentioned on the synagogue in Manchester. We brought that programme from Heaton Park that next morning. We spoke to people outside their homes who couldn't get back in. We spoke to one woman who got married at that particular synagogue. And it was, when you look at the figures from the last year, that was the worst day of the entire year, that attack.
That's correct. This was the first fatal terrorist attack targeting the Jewish community in this country that anyone can remember. It was a shattering day for the Jewish community. And on top of all the pain and the horror of that day, we now see that there was a small minority of people around the country who, rather than feeling the sympathy and the horror that most people felt, they actually went out and carried out more anti-Semitic harassment and abuse as a result of that attack. It was the worst day last year for anti-Semitic incidents reported to CST. The following day, the day after the Heaton Park attack, was the same number of incidents, so also the joint worst day. It's hard to get your head around, really, but it's a sign of just how deeply entrenched this prejudice is with some people, that they see two Jewish people have been killed in a synagogue on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish year, and rather than responding, as the vast majority of people in this country did, with sympathy and horror, it brings out more of their hatred of Jewish people and they go out and express it. The mind boggles.
And just describe to me, Dave, we talked there about one of the most violent attacks, but when you describe anti-Semitic incidents, there is a real range and a spectrum. Some of them are very violent, as we were describing, but some of them seem much smaller on the face of it, but are designed to make people feel vulnerable and frightened because of who they are.
That's correct. We get reports from people across the Jewish community all the time of harassment and abuse and threats that they've directly experienced or things they've seen online and so on. Thankfully, the vast majority of these do not involve violence. But in some ways, the verbal incidents are more shocking because the most common type of incident reported to us will involve an ordinary Jewish person just going about their business and some random stranger sees that they're Jewish and shouts abuse or threats at them. And this is increasing. And the idea that so many people who feel this hatred and this bigotry also feel the confidence to express it, whether that's in person or online, they obviously think that people will agree with them, that there'll be no cost to them to expressing that prejudice. And I think that's a very large reason about why this is spreading.
What more needs to be done, Dave?
We get lots of support from the government for security. There's lots of funding for security guards. We try and work with the police to get more prosecutions. But I think that can only deal with the symptoms. We have to recognise that there are hateful ideologies and extremisms that are driving this anti-Semitism, that are pushing the number of hate crimes and hate incidents up every year, and that can even generate, as we tragically saw last year, a deadly terrorist attack on a synagogue. And we need to find really far-reaching and effective ways to tackle that extremism and those hateful ideologies.
Dave Rich, Director of Policy at the Community Safety Trust, Community Security Trust, thank you.
This morning from 9 o'clock on Radio 3 Unwind, join Dr. Sian Williams on her visit to a duck pond alongside inspiring pieces by Schubert, Emily Meyer and J.S. Bach. You can find Radio 3 Unwind on your digital radio next to Radio 3, or you can search Unwind on BBC Sounds.
If you have ever felt lonely or cut off from the world when you're looking after young children, and just those moments where you're struggling a bit to cope with it, would the ability to sit down next to someone on a bench and find a listening ear help? Well, English Heritage has launched what it's calling bonding benches, clearly marked places at tourist attractions where parents and carers can go and find someone to have a chat about the challenges with. Emma Fernandez-Lopez is Assistant Operations Director at English Heritage, and Lucy Jones is the author of Matrescence and a columnist for The Guardian as well. Morning, both.
Good morning.
So, Emma, tell me, first of all, the idea is that if you go and sit in one of these places, then somebody knows that what they know that you want to talk and they know what you want to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. So the bonding benches are such a great initiative. How they work is that you have the opportunity to sit down on the bench, and there's a slider which basically gives you a choice as a new parent or an established parent to say whether or not you're up for a chat or whether or not you're just craving a bit of peace and quiet. And as a mother of three, I know that every day is never quite the same. So it's a brilliant opportunity for people to make those connections that can stay with them forever. And English Heritage are really proud of, you know, being part of trying to tackle this growing issue amongst, you know, kind of parents in terms of feeling lonely and isolated. We've got about a third of our visitors to English Heritage sites come from families. So we want to be part of the solution to help with the 62% of new parents, particularly that feel a sense of loneliness. And I think it's 87% of them feel overwhelmed at some point in becoming a new parent.
Yeah. And Lucy, that signposting is quite useful as well, because sometimes you're not your normal self. And whereas maybe, you know, you before children might have quite confidently started a conversation with somebody, and in that sort of stage, it can be a bit harder.
It's a fantastic initiative because it draws attention to this critically important area where we as a society are failing, which is new motherhood and new parenthood and the early years of life. And as Emma says, one element of that is isolation and loneliness, which can be central to perinatal health problems. And we know that one aspect of that is the disavowal or neglect of caregivers and babies and young children in public spaces. You know, benches might seem like a small thing to some people, but actually not having benches where you can feed and sit with a baby, not having public transport or trains and buses, which are easy to get onto with a young child, not having walkable cities or towns. We have very car dominated public spaces, that absolutely contributes to this maternal mental health crisis that we're having now. So I welcome this, and I hope it causes a domino ripple effect where other local authorities and councils and businesses will start to centre caregivers and young children in the way we design our society.
Yeah, it's an important part of it, Lucy, isn't it? Because when, you know, as you say, it can just involve a monumental effort to get out of the house. But then when you are in there, you know, running around or getting fresh air or whatever it is, you know, it's worth doing. But as you say, it can be quite difficult if things aren't set up for you. And at least these are tourist attractions where you know that things will be nice. You can have a bit of a break, hopefully.
Yeah, I think it's a step as well to kind of acknowledging that the way we are raising children and expecting people to become mothers and parents today is very different to our evolutionary history. So we know that 80 to 90% of new mothers feel lonely. Some new mothers today might be spending 8 hours alone with a baby. You know, compared with our history of evolving in collective caregiving groups, you know, there's no wonder there's this kind of evolutionary mismatch and really big rates of kind of stress and depression in new mothers. So I hope this is a step, and I applaud English Heritage because, you know, we urgently need to create a family-friendly society and start to value caregivers and young children.
Well, hopefully it will make a difference. Thank you both, Lucy Jones and Emma Fernandez-Lopez.
5 to 9. Well, in recent years, there's also been a lot of attention on and talk about a crisis for boys, about this whole issue of masculinity. And those who worry about it point to worsening educational outcomes, suicide rates, joblessness, and a cultural script that often feels to these critics like a series of don'ts, telling boys what they can't do, what they're not to do, rather than what they can do. But a new show at the South Bank Centre is coming up with a new cultural script. It's called The Show for Young Men. It's a dance show about masculinity in which 45-year-old Robbie and 11-year-old Alfie dance and play together around a building site. And Ian McKenzie is the theatre maker director of The Show for Young Men, which is on at the South Bank Centre, and joins us now. Ian, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, huge congratulations. Tell us about this show. What's the idea behind it?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a massive topic, obviously, to address.
Yeah, you've just got for masculinity, the big old issue.
Yeah. So I think really at its core, what it's about is trying to find a way to present or renegotiate masculinity. And I think that responds to the fact that in the world, there's definitely a lack of role models. There's a lack of images or cultural scripts where masculinity can be compassionate, gentle, careful, loving. And so The Show for Young Men is really trying to present a dynamic between a man and a boy, which opens up possibilities for young boys, but also for men, and also for anyone who has a connection to men in their own life.
You grew up in the East End of Glasgow, I read. What kind of role models did you have?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of role models, a lot of folk who love to make people laugh, who love to be really stoic, who love to stay quiet about their own emotions. And so I think when I was sort of grown up and beginning to consider my own masculinity and the kind of man that I wanted to be, I was trying to find a way of being in the world that maybe wasn't trapped in all of those things, that could be more open, could be more vulnerable, could be more caring.
Yeah. You know, the great Wayne McGregor has looked at these issues as well and explored why dance is a particularly good and sometimes surprising way of exploring these issues. What is the appeal of dance specifically? What can dance do that other kinds of art can't in exploring these issues?
Well, the way that I approach dance in this work is that it's a negotiation. So it's a physical negotiation. It's between play and responsibility, between power and care, between vulnerability and learned behaviour. And I guess in terms of the theme of masculinity, in terms of this inquiry, it's something that's inherited in our embodiment of it. So dance feels like a really immediate way to respond to it, to propose something that's more optimistic. It's not about diagnosing it. It's not about trying to create something that's verbal or analytical. It's movement that reveals a relationship or a different kind of relationship.
And there's something wonderful about inviting the audience to see it through both the 45-year-old's eyes in the character Robbie and also an 11-year-old. I mean, in adolescence, that huge Netflix series, The Star, I think played by Owen Cooper, was a little bit older. But there is something about seeing modern issues through a child's eyes which are particularly moving.
Yeah, for sure. And I think with Alfie in The Show for Young Men, he is this kind of beacon of hope in a way, you know? He is about revealing something that I guess we lose as we grow up, and I guess proposing that we should remain playful.